4. Locke didn't find it particularly easy to eat lunch while watching a dozen swimming men being pulled apart by a Gerishti devilfish, but he decided that his master merchant of Emberlane had probably seen worse in his many imaginary sea voyages, and he kept his true feelings far from his face. Noon was well past, the penance bouts were over, and the revel masters had moved on to the judicial forfeitures. This was a polite way of saying that the men in the water were murderers, rapists, slavers, and arsonists, selected to be colourfully executed for the amusement of the revel crowds. Technically speaking, they were armed and would receive lesser sentences if they could somehow contrive to slay whatever beast they were matched against. But the beasts were always as nasty as their weapons were laughable, so mostly they were just executed. The devilfish's tentacles were 12 feet long, the same length as its undulating grey and black striped body. The creature was confined within a 60-foot circle of cages and platforms, along with a number of screaming, flailing, water-treading men, most of whom had long since dropped their slender little daggers into the water. Nervous guards, armed with crossbows and pikes, patrolled the platform, shoving prisoners back into the water if they tried to scramble out. Occasionally, the devilfish would roll over in the churning red waters, and Locke would catch a glimpse of one lidless black eye the size of a soup bowl, not unlike the bowl currently held in his hands.
"More, Master Fairwhite?"
Conte hovered nearby with the silver tureen of chilled soup cradled in his hands. White-fleshed iron sea prawns floated in a heavy red tomato base seasoned with peppers and onions. Don and Doña Salvara were a peculiar sort of droll.
"No, Conte, most kind, but I'm well satisfied for the time being."
Locke set his soup bowl down beside the broached cask of 559, actually a bottle of lowly 50-crown 550 liberally mixed with the roughest overpriced rum Jean had been able to get his hands on, and took a sip of the amber liquor from his snifter. Even mixed with crap, the counterfeit was delicious. Grauman stood attentively behind Locke's hosts, who were seated opposite Locke at the intimate little table of oiled silverwood. Doña Sofia toyed unselfconsciously with a subtlety of gelled orange slices, paper thin and arranged in whorls to form edible tulip blossoms. Don Lorenzo stared down at the snifter of brandy in his hands, his eyes still wide.
"It seems almost sacrilegious."
Despite this sentiment, the Don took a deep gulp of the stuff, satisfaction well evident in the lines of his face. In the distance behind him, something that might have been a severed torso flew up into the air and came back down with a splash. The crowd roared approval. Osterschalin brandy was famously aged for a minimum of 7 years after distillation and blending. It was impossible for outsiders to get their hands on a cask any sooner than that. The house of Bell Oster's factors were forbidden even to speak of the batches that were not yet on sale. The location of the vintners' aging houses was a secret that was reportedly guarded by assassination when necessary. Don Lorenzo had been struck stupid when Locke had casually offered up a cask of 559. He had nearly thrown up when Locke had just as casually opened the seal and suggested they share it with lunch.
"It is," Locke chuckled. "The brandy is the religion of my house. So many rules, so many rituals, so many penalties."
No longer smiling, he drew a quick finger across his throat.
"It's possible we're the only people in history to have an unaged sample with a lunch of soup. I thought you might enjoy it."
"I am."
The Don swirled the liquor in his glass and stared at it, as though hypnotized by the soft caramel-colored translucence.
"And I'm dead serious about what sort of scheme you've got up your sleeve, Lucas."
"Well,"
Locke swirled his own drink theatrically,
"there have been 3 invasions of Emberlane in the past 250 years. Let's be frank. The succession rights of the Kingdom of the Marrows always involves armies and blood before they involve blessings and banquets. When the Grafs quarrel, the Ostershalin Mountains are only landward barrier and the site of heavy fighting. This fighting inevitably spills down the eastern slopes of the mountains, right through the vineyards of the House of Bel Oster. How could it be different this time? Thousands of men and horses coming over the passes, trampling the vineyards, sacking everything in sight. It might even be worse now that we have fire oil. Our vineyards could be ashes half a year from now. You can't exactly pack your vineyards up and take them with you if you jump ship, said Don Lorenzo. No, Locke sighed. It's the Ostershalin soils, in part, that make Ostershalin brandy. If we lose those vineyards, it will be just as it was before, an interruption of growth and distillation. 10, 20, maybe even 30 years, or more. And it gets worse. Our position is terrible. The Graf can't let Emberlane's ports and revenue go if the Marrows are coming to civil war. He and his allies will storm the place as fast as possible. They'll likely put the Black Table to the sword, impound their goods and properties, nationalize their funds. The House of Bel Oster won't be spared. At the moment, the Black Table is acting quietly but firmly. Grau and I sailed 5 days ago, just 12 hours before we knew the port would be sealed off. No Emberlane-flagged ships are being allowed out. They're all being docked and secured for repairs or quarantine. Nobles still loyal to the Graf are under house arrest by now, their guards disarmed. Our funds in various lending houses of Emberlane have been temporarily frozen. All the Black Table merchant houses have consented to do this to one another. It makes it impossible for any house to flee en masse with its gold and its goods. Currently, Grau and I are operating on our local credit line, established at Maraggio's years ago. My house, well, we simply didn't keep our funds outside Emberlane, just a bit here and there for emergencies. Locke watched the Salvaras very closely for their reaction. His news from Emberlane was as fresh and specific as possible, but the Don might have sources of intelligence the gentleman bastards hadn't spotted in their weeks of surveillance and preparation. The parts about the Black Table and the impending civil war were solid, educated speculation. The part about a sudden port closure and house arrests was pure homespun bullshit. In Locke's estimation, the real mess in Emberlane wouldn't start for a few months. If the Don was wise to this, the game might be blown. Conte might be trying to pin Locke to the table with his daggers in just a few seconds. And then Jean would pull out the hatchets he had concealed down the back of his vest, and everyone in the little group beneath the silk awning would get very, very uncomfortable. But the Salvaras said nothing. They merely continued to stare at him with eyes that plainly invited him to go on. Emboldened, he continued. "This situation is unbearable. We will neither be hostages to a cause that we barely profess, nor victims for the Graf's vengeance upon his inevitable return. We choose a somewhat risky alternative, one that would require substantial aid from a noble of Camor. You, Don Salvara, if it is within your means." The Don and his wife had clasped hands under the table. He waved his hand at Locke excitedly. "We can surrender our funds. By taking no steps to secure them, we buy ourselves more time to act. And we are quite confident that replacing those funds will merely be a matter of time and effort. We can even abandon..." Locke gritted his teeth. "We can even abandon our vineyards. We will completely burn them ourselves, leaving nothing to anyone else. After all, we enhance the soil ourselves, alchemically. And the secret of that enhancement is kept only in the hearts of our planting masters."
"The Ostershalin process,"
Sophia breathed, betrayed by her own rising excitement. "Of course, you've heard of it. Well, there are only 3 planting masters at any given time. and the process is complex enough to defy soil examination, even by someone with talents such as yours, my lady. Many of the compounds our alchemists use are inert, and intended only to confuse the matter. So that's that. The one thing we cannot abandon is our stock of aging blends, the last 6 years batched in their casks, and certain rare vintages and special experiments. We store the Osterschalin in 32-gallon casks. There are nearly 6,000 such casks in our possession. We have to get them out of Emberlane. We have to do it in the next few weeks, before the Black Table imposes harsher control measures, and before the Graf begins laying siege to his canton. And now our ships are under guard, and all of our funds are untouchable.
You want to get all of these casks out of Emberlane? All of them?
The Don actually gulped. As many as possible, said Locke.
And for this you would involve us how?
Doña Sofia was fidgeting. Emberlane flagged ships can no longer leave port, nor enter if they wish to escape again, but a small flotilla of Camorre-flagged ships with Camorre crews financed by a Camorre noble. Locke set his glass of brandy down and spread both his hands in the air.
You wish me to provide a naval expedition?
Two or three of your larger galleons should do it. We're looking at 1,000 tons of cargo, casks and brandy alike. Minimal crew, say 50 or 60 men a ship. We can take our pick of the docks and get sober, trustworthy captains. 6 or 7 days beating north, plus however long it takes to scratch the crews and ships together. I guess less than a week. Do you concur?
A week, yes, but you're asking me to finance all of this?
In exchange for a most handsome recompense, I assure you.
Provided everything goes well, yes, and we'll come to the matter of recompense in a moment, but just the rapid acquisition of 2 galleons, good captains, and very reliable crews.
Plus, said Locke, something to stick in the hold for the trip north. Cheap grain, dried cheese, low-grade fresh fruit, nothing special. But Emberlane will shortly be under siege. The Black Table will be happy to have a cache of extra supplies offloaded. Emberlane's position is too tenuous to fail to respect the sovereign neutrality of Camorre. That's what my masters are counting on to get the ships in and out. But added assurance cannot hurt.
Yes, said Don Lorenzo, tugging on his lower lip. 2 galleons, crews, officers, cheap cargo. A small crew of mercenaries, 10 or 12 a ship. There are always some hanging around the Viscount's gate this time of year. I'd want a hard corps of armed men on each ship to discourage complications.
Locke nodded.
So how exactly would we go about removing the casks from your aging houses and transporting them to the docks?
A very simple ruse, said Locke. We maintain several breweries and storehouses for small beer. It's a sideline, a sort of hobby for some of our blending masters. Our beer is stored in casks, and the location of these warehouses is public knowledge. Slowly, carefully, while Grau and I sailed south, my masters have been moving casks of Osterschalin brandy to the beer warehouses and relabeling them. They will continue to do so while we prepare here, and until our ships appear in the harbour of Emberlane.
So you won't be loading brandy in secret?
Doña Sofia clapped her hands together.
As far as anyone knows, you'll be loading beer in the open.
Exactly, my lady. Even the large export of beer won't be anywhere near as suspicious as a movement of the unaged brandy. It'll be looked on as a commercial coup. We'll be the first to dodge the interdict on Emberlane-flagged vessels. We'll bring in a pile of supplies for the coming siege, and a fine apparent profit for ourselves. Then, once we've got all the brandy loaded, we'll put out to sea, bringing 60 or 70 Bell Oster family and employees to form the nucleus of our new business operations in Camor. Discovery after that will be immaterial. All of this to be thrown together on short notice. Don Lorenzo was deep in thought. 15,000 crowns, I'd say. Perhaps 20.
I concur, my lord. Count on an additional 5,000 or so for bribes and other arrangements.
Locke shrugged. Certain men are going to have to look the other way for us to do our job when we reach Emberlane, warehouse ruse or no.
25,000 crowns, then.
Damn. Lorenzo downed the last of the brandy in his glass, set it down, and folded his hands together on the table before him.
You're asking me for more than half of my fortune. I like you, Lucas, but now it's time to discuss the other side of the proposal.
Of course. Lucas stopped to offer the Don another dash of the counterfeit unaged. The Don began to wave him off, but his taste buds prevailed over his better judgment, and he held out his glass. Doña Sofia did so as well, and Jean hurried over to pass her glass between her and Locke. When he'd served the Salvaras, Locke poured a companionably large amount into his own snifter.
First, you have to understand what the House of Bell Oster is and is not offering. You will never have the Osterschalen process. It will continue to be passed down verbally and strictly within the house. We can afford you no properties as collateral or in payment. We expect to forfeit them upon fleeing Emberlane. Resecuring the vineyards at a future date is our own problem. Any effort on your part to pry into the Osterschalen process to suborn any Bell Oster men or women will be regarded as an absolute breach of trust.
Locke sipped brandy.
I have no idea what specific penalties we could levy to express our displeasure, but it would be fully expressed. I am instructed to be entirely clear on this point.
And so you are.
Doña Sofia placed one hand on her husband's left shoulder. But these limitations are not yet an offer.
Forgive me, gracious Doña Sofia, for speaking to you like this, but you must understand this is the most important thing the House of Bell Oster has ever contemplated. Grau and I hold the future of our combine in our rather vulnerable hands. At this moment, I can't speak to you just as your luncheon guest, Lucas Fairwhite. I am the House of Bell Oster. You have to understand that some things are not on the table, not even by the most remote implication.
The Salvaras nodded as one, Sophia just a bit more slowly than Lorenzo.
Now, consider the situation. War is coming to Emberlane. Our vineyards and our properties are as good as lost. And without those vineyards, there will be no Osterschalen actually produced for only the Marrows know how long. 10 years? A generation? Even when we have the vineyards back, the soil will need years to recover. This is the way it has been 3 times before. For many, many years to come, the only new Osterschalen available is going to come from whatever portion of those 6,000 casks we can move out of Emberlane, like thieves in the night. Imagine the demand! The price escalation!
The Don's lips moved unconsciously as he calculated. Doña Sofia stared off into the distance, her brow furrowed. Osterschalen brandy was the finest and most sought-after liquor known. Even the alchemical wines of Tal Varrar, in 100 bewitching varieties, were not as expensive. A single half-gallon bottle of the youngest available Osterschalen was 30 full crowns at retail. The price went up sharply with age. With a surprise shortage, a fixed supply, and no new crop of Osterschalen grapes in sight?
Fuck them!
Said Conte, totally unable to help himself when the sums involved vanished over his mental horizon.
Beg pardon, Doña Sofia.
You should.
She drained her snifter in one quick unladylike gulp.
Your calculations are off.
This merits a triple fuck-damn at least.
The House of Bel Oster, Locke continued, wishes to establish a partnership with you, based in Camor, to store and market Osterschalen brandy during our interregnum. In exchange for your assistance in transporting it from Emberlane in our moment of extreme need, we are prepared to offer you 50% of the proceeds from the sale of anything you transport for us. Again, consider the situation and the price of Osterschalen during a shortage. You could recoup your initial investment 10 times over in the first year. Give us 5 years, or 10.
Yes, Don Lorenzo fiddled with his optics. But Lucas, somehow, sitting here discussing the possible destruction of your house and the move to a city 500,000 miles to the south, you don't sound entirely displeased.
Locke used a particularly endearing wry smile he'd once practiced before a mirror glass for weeks.
When my masters grasped the essence of their current situation, some of them suggested we should have engineered an artificial shortage years ago. As it is, we are determined that we can turn a painful setback into a glorious return. Those 6,000 casks, sold at shortage prices over a number of years, we could return to Emberlane with a fortune that eclipses everything we'd be leaving behind. And as for your own situation,
we're not talking about hundreds of thousands of crowns. Doña Sofia returned from her thoughtful trance. We're talking about millions, even split between us.
It would be foolish to presume too much, but yes, there is the possibility that the sums involved could reach such figures. My masters are also prepared to grant one final compensation upon our successful return to Emberlane and the restoration of the Osterschalen vineyards. We offer your family a permanent stake in all Bel Oster operations thereafter. Certainly nothing close to a controlling interest, but something respectable, a 10 to 15% share. You would be the first, and, we hope, the only foreigners ever offered such an interest.
There was a brief pause.
That's a very attractive offer, Don Salvara said at last. And to think all this was going to fall into Jacobo's lap simply by default. By the gods, Lucas, if we ever cross paths with those thieves again, I'm going to thank them for arranging our introduction.
Well, Locke chuckled, I, for my part, can let bygones be bygones. Grauman might feel somewhat differently. And the fact remains that while I sense we may be shaking hands very soon, we still have to assemble our ships, sail north to Emberlane, and snatch up our prize. The situation is like a damaged cargo rope, unravelling down to a single thread.
He saluted the Salvaras with his brandy snifter.
It will snap!
Out on the water, the devilfish was victorious, and the guards rewarded it for its service by filling it with poisoned crossbow bolts. Boat hooks and chains were used to haul the carcass out of the center of the shifting revel. There was just no putting a creature like that back into the box once it had served its purpose. The monster's red blood mixed with that of its victims and slowly settled in a broad, dark cloud. Even this had a deliberate part to play in what was to come next.
5. Scholars of the Therin Collegium, from their comfortable position well inland, could tell you that the wolf sharks of the Iron Sea are beautiful and fascinating creatures, their bodies more packed with muscle than any bull, their abrasive hide streaked with every colour from old copper green to storm cloud black. Anyone actually working the waterfront in Camor and on the nearby coast could tell you that wolf sharks are big, aggressive bastards that like to jump. Carefully caged, starved, and maddened by blood, wolf sharks are the key to the customary highlight of the shifting revel. Other cities have gladiatorial games, other cities pit men against animals,
But only in Camor can you see a specially armed gladiator, a contrarrechiala, battle a live, leaping shark. And in Camor, only women are allowed by tradition to be contrarrechiala. This is the teeth show. 6. Locke couldn't tell if the four women were truly beautiful, but they were undeniably striking. They were all dark-skinned Camori with muscles like farm girls, imposing even at a distance, and they wore next to nothing, tight black cotton shifts across their chests, wrestlers' loincloths, and thin leather gloves. Their black hair was pulled back under the traditional red bandanas and threaded with brass and silver bangles that caught the sunlight in chains of white flashes. The purpose of these bangles was a matter of argument. Some claimed that they confused the poor eyesight of the sharks, while just as many claimed that their glare helped the monsters better sight their prey. Each contrarrechiala carried two weapons, a short javelin in one hand and a special axe in the other. These axes had grips enclosed by full hand guards, making them difficult to lose. They were double-headed, with the expected curved blade on one side and a long, sturdy pickhead on the other. A skilled fighter usually tried to slash a shark's fins and tail to nothing before making a kill. Few but the very best could kill with anything but the spike. Wolf shark skin could be like tree bark. Locke stared at the grim women and felt his usual melancholy admiration. They were, to his eyes, as mad as they were courageous. "I know that's Cecilia de Ricura there on the far left." Don Lorenzo was pointing the women out for Lucas Fairwright's benefit, taking a break from more than an hour of rapid negotiations. "She's decent, and beside her is Agnesa, who carries her javelin but never ever uses it. The other two, well, they must be new, at least new to the revel." "It's so unfortunate," said the Doña, "that the Barangius sisters aren't out there today, Master Fairwhite. They're the best."
"Probably the best there ever has been."
Don Salvara squinted to cut some of the glare rising off the water and tried to estimate the size of the sharks, barely visible as shadows within their cages.
"Or ever will be. But they haven't been at the revel for the past few months."
Locke nodded and chewed on the inside of one of his cheeks. As Locke Lamora, garista of the Gentleman Bastards and respectable sneak thief, he knew the Barangius twins personally. He also knew exactly where they'd been for those past few months. Out on the water, the first fighter was taking her position. Contrarrechiala fought across a series of stepping stone platforms, each about 2 feet wide and raised half a foot off the water. These platforms were set out in a square grid, 4 or 5 feet apart, leaving plenty of room for the opposition to swim between them. The women would have to hop between these platforms at a rapid pace to strike out at the sharks, while dodging leaps in return. A slip into the water was usually the end of the contest. Beyond the line of shark cages, opened by chain pulleys connected to a barge well beyond the periphery of any possible shark activity, there was a little boat, crewed by extremely well-paid volunteer rowers, and carrying the three traditional observers of any teeth show. First, there was a priest of Yono, in his sea-green robes fringed with silver. Beside him, there was a black-robed, silver-masked priestess of Azaguiya, Lady of the Long Silence, Goddess of Death. Lastly, there was a physiker, whose presence had always struck Locke as an extremely optimistic gesture.
"Camor!"
The young woman, apparently Cecilia de Ricura, raised her weapons into the air over her head. The heavy murmur of the crowd subsided, leaving only the noise of water lapping against boats and breakwaters. 15,000 watchers held their collective breath.
"I dedicate this death to Duke Nicovante, our lord and patron!"
Such was the traditional phrasing of the Contrarrechiala's salute. This death could conveniently refer to either participant in the battle.
With a great flourish of trumpets and the cheer of the crowd, the boatmen outside the circle of cages loosed the afternoon's first shark. The 10-foot fish, already blood-mad, shot forth from imprisonment and began to circle the stepping platforms, its ominous grey fin slicing a ripple line in the water. Cecilia balanced on one foot and bent down to slap the water with the heel of the other, screaming oaths and challenges. The shark took the bait. In a few seconds it was in amongst the platforms, stocky body whipping back and forth like a toothy pendulum.
"This one doesn't like to waste time!" Don Salvara actually wrung his hands together. "I bet it's an early leaper!"
Barely had these words escaped his mouth than the shark rocketed up out of the water in a fountain of silver spray, hurling itself at the crouching fighter. The shark's leap was not a high one. Cecilia avoided it by jumping right to the next platform over. In midair, she let her javelin go with a backhanded cast. The shaft sunk into the shark's flank and quivered there for a split second before the streamlined mass of hungry muscle splashed back down into the water. Crowd reaction was mixed. The cast had displayed remarkable agility but minimal power. Cecilia's shark was likely only further angered and her javelin wasted.
"Oh, poor decision," the Doña clicked her tongue. "This girl needs to learn some patience. We'll see if her new friend gives her the chance."
Thrashing, spraying pink-foamed water, the shark maneuvered for another attack, chasing Cecilia's shadow on the water. She hopped from platform to platform, axe reversed so the spike was facing outward.
"Master Fairwhite." Don Lorenzo removed his optics and played with them while he watched the fight. Apparently, they weren't necessary for use at long distances.
"I can accept your terms, but you have to appreciate that my portion of the initial risk is quite heavy, especially relative to my total available funds. My request, therefore, is that the split of revenues from our Osterschalin sales be adjusted to 55-45. In my favor."
Locke pretended to ponder while Cecilia pumped her arms and leapt for dear life, the eager grey fin slashing through the water just behind her feet.
"I'm authorized to make such a concession on behalf of my masters. In return, I would fix your family's ownership interest in the resecured Osterschalin vineyards at 5%.
"Done!"
The Don smiled.
"I will fund 2 large galleons, crew and officers, necessary bribes and arrangements, and a cargo to take north with us. I'll oversee 1 galleon, you the other. Mercenary crews of my choosing to be placed aboard each vessel for added security. Conte will travel with you. Your Grauman can stay at my side. Any expenditures that bring our budget over 25,000 Camori crowns are to be made solely at my discretion."
The shark leapt and missed again. Cecilia performed a brief one-armed handstand on her platform, waving her axe. The audience roared while the shark rolled over gracelessly in the water and came back for another pass.
"Agreed," said Locke. "Signed identical copies of our contract to be kept by each of us. 1 additional copy in Therin to be kept with a mutually agreeable neutral solicitor, to be opened and examined by them within the month should one of us have an accident while fetching the casks. 1 additional copy in Vadran to be signed and placed into the care of an agent known to me for eventual delivery to my masters. I shall require a bonded scribe at the Tumble home this evening, and a promissory note for 5,000 crowns to be drawn at Maraggio's tomorrow, so I can get to work immediately."
"And that is all that remains?"
"Quite everything," said Locke.
The Don was silent for several seconds.
"The hell with it. I agree. Let's clasp hands and take our chances."
Out on the water, Cecilia paused and hefted her axe, timing a blow as the shark approached her platform on her right, undulating, moving too slow for a high leap. Just as Cecilia shifted her weight to bring the spike down, the shark jackknifed in the water beside her, squeezing its body into a U-shape, and drove itself straight downward. This manoeuvre flicked its tail into the air, catching the contrarrechiala just under her knees. Screaming more in shock than in pain, Cecilia de Ricura fell backward into the water. It was all over a few seconds after that. The shark came up biting and must have taken her by one or both legs. They turned over and over in the water a few times. Locke caught glimpses of the frantic woman's form alternating with the dark, rough hide of the shark. White, then grey. White, then grey. In moments the pink foam was dark red once more, and the two struggling shadows were sinking into the depths beneath the platforms. Half the crowd roared lusty approval. The rest bowed their heads in a respectful silence that would last just until the next young woman entered the ring of red water.
Gods!
Doña Sofia stared at the spreading stain on the water. The surviving fighters stood with their heads lowered, and the priests were gesturing some sort of mutual blessing.
Unbelievable! Taken in so fast by such a simple trick! Well, my father used to say that one moment of misjudgment at the revel is worth 10 at any other time.
Locke bowed deeply to her, taking one hand and kissing it.
I doubt him not at all, Doña Sofia, not at all.
Smiling amiably, he bowed to her once more, then turned to shake hands with her husband.
Interlude. Locke stays for dinner. 1.
What?
Locke nearly jumped to his feet.
What are you talking about?
My boy, said Chains, my intermittently brilliant little boy. Your world has such small horizons. You can see clearly enough to pull a fast one on someone, but you can't see past the immediate consequences. Until you learn to think ahead of the repercussions, you are putting yourself and everyone around you in danger. You can't help being young, but it's past time that you stopped being stupid, so listen carefully. Your first mistake was that taking coin from the watch isn't a beating offence. It's a killing offence. Are we clear on that? Here in Camor, the watch takes our coin, and never the other way around. This rule is set in stone, and there are no exceptions, no matter what kind of thief you are. It's death. It's a throat-slashing, shark-feeding, off-to-meet-the-gods offence. Clear?
Locke nodded.
So when you set Veslin up, you really set him up. But you compounded this mistake when you used a white iron coin. You know how much a full crown is worth, exactly?
Lots.
Ah, lots isn't exactly. You don't speak Theron, or you don't really know.
I guess I don't really know.
Well, if everything's butter and nobody's been shaving the damn things, that little piece of shiny white iron was worth 40 silver solons. You see? 240 coppers. Your eyes are wide. That means you can think that big. That you understand?
Yes. Wow.
Yes. Wow. Let me put it in perspective. A yellow jacket, one of our selfless and infinitely dutiful city watchmen, might make that much for 2 months of daily duty. And watchmen are decently paid for common folk, and they sure as blessed shit do not get paid in white iron.
Eh?
So not only was Veslin taking money, he was taking too much money. A full crown. You can buy a death for much less, yours included.
How much did you pay for my...
Locke tapped his chest, where the death mark still hung beneath his shirt.
I don't mean to prick your rather substantial opinion of yourself, but I'm still not sure if it was 2 coppers wisely spent.
At the boy's expression, Chains barked out a rich, genuine laugh, but then his voice grew serious once again.
Keep guessing, boy. But the point remains. You can get good, hard men to do serious work for less. You could buy 5 or 6 major pieces of business, if you know what I mean. So when you stuck a white iron coin in Veslin's things,
it was too much money for anything simple?
Dead on. Far too much money for information or errands. Nobody in their right mind gives a fucking graveyard urchin a full crown. Unless that urchin is being paid to do something big. Kill your old master, for example. Smoke out all of Shades Hill and everyone in it. So if the poor thief-maker was upset to discover that Veslin was on the take, you can imagine how he felt when he saw how much money was involved. Locke nodded furiously. Ah, so. 2 mistakes. Your third mistake was involving Gregor. Was Gregor supposed to get hit with the ugly stick?
I didn't like him, but no. I just wanted Veslin. Maybe I wanted Gregor to get a little, but not as much as Veslin.
Just so. You had a target, and you had a twist to play on that target, but you didn't control the situation. So your game for Veslin spilled over, and Gregor Foss got the knife too.
That's what I said, isn't it? I already admitted it.
Angry now? My, yes, you would be. Angry that you fucked up. Angry that you're not as clever as you think. Angry that the gods gave lots of other people the same sort of brain they gave Locke Lamora. Quite the pisser, isn't it?
Locke blew his little lamp out with one quick breath, then flung it in an arc, as high over the parapet as his slender arm could throw. The crash of its landing was lost in the murmur of the busy Camorri night. The boy crossed his arms defensively.
Well, it certainly is nice to be free from the threat of that lamp, my boy.
Chains drew a last breath of smoke, then rubbed his dwindling sheaf of tobacco out against the roof stones.
Was it informing for the Duke, plotting to murder us?
Locke said nothing, teeth clenched and lower lip protruding. Petulance, the natural non-verbal language of the very young. Chains snorted.
I do believe everything you've told me, Locke, because I had a long talk with your former master before I took you off his hands. Like I said, he told me everything. He told me about your last and biggest mistake, the one that tipped him off and got you sent here. Can you guess what it might have been?
Locke shook his head.
Can't or won't?
I really don't know.
Locke looked down.
I hadn't actually thought about it.
You showed other kids in streets the white iron coin, didn't you? You had them help you look for it. You let some of them know what it might be used for, and you ordered them not to talk about it. But what did you, back that order up with?
Locke's eyes widened. His pout returned, but his petulance evaporated.
They hated Veslin, too. They wanted to see him get it.
Of course. Maybe that was enough for one day. But what about later? After Veslin was dead, and Gregor was dead, and your master had had a chance to cool down some and reflect on the situation? What if he started asking questions about a certain Lamora boy? What if he took some of your little boon companions from streets and asked them nicely if Locke Lamora had been up to anything unusual, even for him?
Oh,
the boy winced.
Oh. Oh, ho, ho.
Chains reached out and slapped the boy on the shoulder.
Enlightenment! When it comes like a brick to the head, doesn't it?
I guess.
So, said Chains, now you see where everything went wrong. How many boys and girls are in that little hill, Locke? 100, 120, more? How many do you really think your old master could handle if they turned on him?
One or two, no problem. But four? Eight? All of them?
We, I guess we never thought about it.
Because he doesn't rule his graveyard by logic, boy. He rules it by fear. Fear of him keeps the older sprats in line. Fear of them keeps little shits like you in line. Anything that undermines that fear is a threat to his position. Enter Locke Lamora, waving the idiot flag and thinking himself so much cleverer than the rest of the world.
I don't think I'm cleverer than the rest of the world.
You did until 3 minutes ago. Listen, I'm a garista. It means I run a gang, even if it's just a small one. Your old master is a garista, too. The garista of Shades Hill. And when you mess with a leader's ability to rule his gang, out come the knives. How long do you think the thief-maker could control Shades Hill if word got around of how you played him so sweetly? How you jerked him around like a kitten on a chain? He would never have real control over his orphans ever again. They'd push and push until it finally came to blood.
And that's why he got rid of me? But what about streets? What about the ones that helped me get Veslin?
Good questions. Easily answered. Your old master takes orphans in off the streets and keeps them for a few years. Usually he's through with them by the time they're 12 or 13. He teaches them the basics. How to sneak thief and speak the cant and mix with the right people. How to get along in a gang and how to dodge the noose. When he's through with them, he sells them to the bigger gangs, the real gangs. You see? He takes orders. Maybe the grey faces need a second-story girl. Maybe the Arsenal boys want a mean little bruiser. It's a great advantage to the gangs. It brings them suitable new recruits that don't need to have their hands held.
That I know. That's why he sold me to you.
Yes, because you're a very special case. You have profitable skills, even if your aim so far has been terrible. But your little friends in streets, did they have your gifts? They were just regular little coat charmers, simple little teasers. They weren't ripe. Nobody would give a penny for them except slavers, and your old master has one sad old scrap of real conscience. He wouldn't sell one of you to the crimpers for all the coin in Camor.
So what you're saying is he had to do something to all of us that knew about the coin, all of us that could figure it out or tell about it, and I was the only one he could sell.
Correct. And as for the others, well, Chains shrugged. It'll be quick. 2-3 weeks from now, nobody'll even remember their names. You know how it goes in the hill.
I got them killed?
Yes. Chains didn't soften his voice. You really did. As surely as you tried to hurt Veslin, you killed Gregor and 4 or 5 of your little comrades into the bargain.
Shit!
Do you see now what consequences really are? Why you have to move slowly, think ahead, control the situation? Why you need to settle down and wait for time to give you sense to match your talent for mischief? We have years to work together, Locke. Years for you and my other little hellions to practice quietly. And that has to be the rule if you want to stay here. No games, no cons, no scams, no anything except when and where I tell you. When someone like you pushes the world pushes back. Other people are likely to get hurt. Am I clear? Locke nodded. Now. Chains snapped his shoulders back and rolled his head from side to side. There was a series of snaps and cracks from somewhere inside him. Ah! Do you know what a death offering is?
No.
It's something we do for the benefactor. Not just those of us who are initiates of the 13th. Something all of us crooks do for one another. All the right people of Camor. When we lose someone we care about, we get something valuable and we throw it away. For real, you understand. Into the sea, into a fire, something like that. We do this to help our friends on their way to what comes next. Clear so far?
Yeah, but my old master...
Oh, he does it, trust me. He's a wretched miser, and he always does it in private, but he does it for each and every one of you he loses. Figures he wouldn't tell you about it, but here's the thing. There's a rule that has to be followed with the offering. It can't be given willingly, you understand? It can't be something you already have. It has to be something you go out and steal from someone else, special, without their permission or their, complicity. Get me? It has to be genuine theft.
Sure.
Father Chains cracked his knuckles. You're going to make a death offering for every single boy or girl you got killed, Locke. One for Veslin, one for Gregor, one for each of your little friends in streets. I'm sure I'll know the count in just a day or two.
But I... they weren't...
Of course they were your friends, Locke. They were your very good friends. Because they're going to teach you that when you kill someone, there are consequences. It is one thing to kill in a duel, to kill in self-defense, to kill for vengeance. It is another thing entirely to kill simply because you are careless. Those deaths are going to hang over your head until you're so careful you make the saints of Perelandro weep. Your death offering will be 1,000 full crowns per head. All of it properly stolen by your own hand.
But I... What? 1,000 crowns? Each? 1,000?
You can take that death mark off your neck when you offer up the last coin of it, and not a moment sooner.
But that's impossible. It'll take forever.
It'll take years, but we're thieves, not murderers, here in my temple. And the price of your life with me is that you must show respect for the dead. Those boys and girls are your victims, Locke. Get that through your head. This is something you owe them before the gods, something you must swear to by blood before you can stay. Are you willing to do so?
Locke seemed to think for a few seconds. Then he shook his head as though to clear it, and nodded.
Then hold out your left hand.
As Locke did so, Chains produced a slender, blackened steel stiletto from within his robe, and drew it across his own left palm. Then, holding Locke's outstretched hand firmly, he scratched a shallow, stinging cut between the boy's thumb and index finger. They shook hands firmly, until their palms were thick with mingled blood.
Then you're a gentleman bastard, like the rest of us. I'm your garista, and you're my pezon, my little soldier. I have your oath in blood to do what I've told you to do, to make the offerings for the souls of the people you've wronged.
I'll do it, Locke said.
Good. That means you can stay for dinner. Let's get down off this roof.
2. Behind the curtained door at the rear of the sanctuary, there was a grimy hall leading to several grimy rooms. Moisture and mould and poverty were on abundant display. There were cells with sleeping pallets, lit by oiled paper lamps that gave off a light the colour of cheap ale. Scrolls and bound books were scattered on the pallets. Robes in questionable states of cleanliness hung from wall hooks.
This is unnecessary nonsense.
Chains gestured to and fro as he led Locke into the room closest to the curtained door, as though showing off a palace.
Occasionally we play host to a tutor or a travelling priest of Perelandro's order, and they have to see what they expect. Chain's own sleeping pallet, for Locke saw that the wall manacles in the other room could surely reach none of the other sleeping chambers back here, was set atop a block of solid stone, a sort of heavy shelf jutting from the wall. Chains reached under the stale blankets, turned something that made a metallic clacking noise, and lifted his bed up as though it were a coffin lid. The blankets turned out to be on some sort of wooden panel with hinges set into the stone. An inviting golden light spilled from within the stone block, along with the spicy smells of high-class Komori cooking. Locke knew that aroma only from the way it drifted out of the Alcigrante district or down from certain inns and houses. "In you go!" Chains gestured once again, and Locke peeked over the lip of the stone block. A sturdy wooden ladder led down a square shaft, just slightly wider than Chain's shoulders. It ended about 20 feet below, on a polished wood floor.
"Don't gawk! Climb!"
Locke obeyed. The rungs of the ladder were wide and rough and very narrowly spaced. He had no trouble moving down it, and when he stepped off, he was in a tall passage that might have been torn out of the Duke's own tower. The floor was indeed polished wood, long, straight, golden-brown boards that creaked pleasantly beneath his feet. The arched ceiling and the walls were entirely covered with a thick, milky golden glass that shone faintly, like a rainy season sun peeking out from behind heavy clouds. The illumination came from everywhere and nowhere. The walls scintillated. With a series of thumps and grunts and jingles, for Locke saw that he now carried the day's donated coins in a small burlap sack, Chains came down and hopped to the floor beside him. He gave a quick tug to a rope tied to the ladder, and the false bed pallet fell back down and locked itself above.
"There. Isn't this much nicer?"
"Yeah." Locke ran one hand down the flawless surface of one of the walls. The glass was noticeably cooler than the air. "It's elder glass, isn't it?"
"Sure as hell isn't plaster."
Chains shooed Locke along the passage to the left, where it turned a corner. "The whole temple cellar is surrounded by the stuff, sealed in it. The temple above was actually built to settle into it hundreds of years ago. There's not a break in it, as far as I can tell, except for one or two little tunnels that lead out to other interesting places. It's flood-tight and never lets in a drop from below, even when the water's waist-deep in the streets, and it keeps out rats and roaches and suckle spiders and all that crap, so long as we mind our comings and goings." The clatter of metal pans and the low giggle of the Sansa brothers reached them from around the corner just before they turned it, entering into a comfortably appointed kitchen with tall wooden cabinets and a long witchwood table surrounded by high-backed chairs. Locke actually rubbed his eyes when he saw their black velvet cushions and the varnished gold leaf that gilded their every surface. Carlo and Galdo were working at a brick cooking shelf, shuffling pans and banging knives over a huge white alchemical hearth slab. Locke had seen smaller blocks of this stone, which gave off a smokeless heat when water was splashed atop it, but this one must have weighed as much as Father Chain's. As Locke watched, Carlo, Galdo, held a pan in the air and poured water from a glass pitcher onto the sizzling slab. The great uprush of steam carried a deep bouquet of sweet cooking smells, and Locke felt saliva spilling down the back of his mouth. In the air over the witchwood table, a striking chandelier blazed. Locke would, in later years, come to recognize it as an armillary sphere, fashioned from glass with an axis of solid gold. At its heart shone an alchemical globe with the white bronze light of the sun. Surrounding this were the concentric glass rings that marked the orbits and processions of the world and all her celestial cousins, including the three moons.
At the outermost edges were 100 dangling stars that looked like spatters of molten glass, somehow frozen at the very instant of their outward explosions. The light ran and glimmered and burned along every facet of the chandelier, yet there was something wrong about it. It was as if the elder glass ceilings and walls were somehow drawing the light out of the alchemical sun, leavening it, weakening it, redistributing it along the full length and breadth of all the elder glass in this uncanny cellar.
"Welcome to our real home, our little temple to the benefactor."
Chains tossed his bag of coins down on the table.
"Our patron has always sort of danced upon the notion that austerity and piety go hand in hand. Down here, we show our appreciation for things by appreciating, if you get me. Boys, look who survived his interview."
"We never doubted," said one twin.
"For even a second," said the other.
"But now can we hear what he did to get himself kicked out of Shades Hill?"
The question, spoken in near perfect unison, had the ring of repeated ritual.
"When you're older."
Chains raised his eyebrows at Locke and shook his head, ensuring the boy could see the gesture clearly.
"Much older."
"Locke, I don't expect that you know how to set a table." When Locke shook his head, Chains led him over to a tall cabinet just to the left of the cooking hearth. Inside were stacks of white porcelain plates. Chains held one up so Locke could see the hand-painted heraldic design, a mailed fist clutching an arrow and a grapevine, and the bright gold gilding on the rim.
"Borrowed," said Chains, "on a rather permanent basis from Doña Isabella Manichezzo, the old dowager aunt of our own Duke Nicovante. She died childless and rarely gave parties, so it wasn't as though she was using them all. You see how some of our acts that might seem purely cruel and larcenous to outsiders are actually sort of convenient, if you look at them in the right way? That's the hand of the benefactor at work, or so we like to think. It's not as though we could tell the difference if he didn't want us to."
Chains handed the plate to Locke, who clutched at it with greatly exaggerated care and peered very closely at the gold rim and ran his right hand lovingly over the surface of the witchwood table.
"Now this used to be the property of Marius Cordo, a master merchant of Tal Verar. He had it in the great cabin of a triple-decker galley. Huge! 86 oars. I was a bit upset with him, so I lifted it, his chairs, his carpets and tapestries, and all of his clothes. Right off the ship. I left his money. I was making a point. I dumped everything but the table into the sea of brass. And that..."
Chains lifted a finger in the direction of the celestial chandelier.
"That was being shipped overland from Ashmir in a guarded wagon convoy for the old Don Leviana. Somehow, in transit, it transformed itself into a box of straw."
Chains took three more plates out of the cabinet and set them in Locke's arms.
"Damn, I was fairly good back when I actually worked for a living."
"Urk," said Locke, under the weight of the fine dinnerware.
"Oh, yeah."
Chains gestured to the chair at the head of the table. "Put one there for me. One for yourself on my left. Two for Carlo and Galdo on my right. If you were my servant, what I'd tell you to lay out is a casual setting. Can you say that for me?"
"A casual setting."
"Right. This is how the high and mighty eat when it's just close blood and maybe a friend or two."
Chains let the set of his eyes and the tone of his voice suggest that he expected this lesson to be retained, and he began to introduce Locke to the intricacies of glasses, linen napkins, and silver eating utensils.
"What kind of knife is this?
Locke held a rounded buttering utensil up for Chain's inspection.
"It's all wrong. You couldn't kill anyone with this."
"Well, not very easily, I'll grant you that, my boy."
Chains guided Locke in the placement of the butter knife and assorted small dishes and bowls. "But when the quality get together to dine, it's impolite to knock anybody off with anything but poison. That thing is for scooping butter, not slicing windpipes."
"This is a lot of trouble to go to just to eat."
"Well, in Shades Hill, you may be able to eat cold bacon and dirt pies off one another's asses for all your old master cares. But now you're a gentleman bastard. Emphasis on the gentleman. You're going to learn how to eat like this and how to serve people who eat like this."
"Why?"
"Because, Locke Lamora, some day you're going to dine with barons and counts and dukes. You're going to dine with merchants and admirals and generals and ladies of every sort. And when you do..."
Chains put two fingers under Locke's chin and tilted the boy's head up so they were eye to eye.
"When you do, those poor idiots won't have any idea that they're really dining with a thief."
3.
"Now, isn't this lovely?"
Chains raised an empty glass and saluted his three young wards at the splendidly furnished table. Steaming brass bowls and heavy crockware held the results of Carlo and Galdo's efforts at the cooking hearth. Locke, seated on an extra cushion to raise his elbows just above the tabletop, stared at the food and the furnishings with wide eyes. He was bewildered at how quickly he had escaped his old life and fallen into this new one with strangely pleasant, crazy people. Chains lifted a bottle of something he'd called alchemical wine. The stuff was viscous and dark, like quicksilver. When he pulled the loosened cork, the air was filled with the scent of juniper. For a brief moment, it overwhelmed the spicy aroma of the main dishes. Chains poured a good measure of the stuff into the empty glass, and in the bright light it ran like molten silver. Chains raised the glass to a level with his eyes.
"A glass poured to air for the one who sits with us unseen, the patron and protector, the crooked warden, the father of necessary pretexts."
"Thanks for deep pockets poorly guarded," said the Sansa brothers in unison, and Locke was caught off guard by the seriousness of their intonation.
"Thanks for watchmen asleep at their posts," said Chains.
"Thanks for the city to nurture us and the night to hide us," was the response.
"Thanks for friends to help spend the loot."
Chains brought the half-filled glass down and set it in the middle of the table. He took up another smaller glass. Into this he poured just a finger of the liquid silver.
"A glass poured to air for an absent friend. We wish Sabitha well and pray for her safe return."
"Maybe we could have her back a little less crazy, though," said one of the Sansas, whom Locke mentally labelled Carlo for convenience. "And humble," Galdo nodded after he'd said this. "Humble would be really great."
"The brothers Sansa wish Sabitha well."
Chains held the little glass of liquor rock steady and eyed the twins.
"And they pray for her safe return."
"Yes. Wish her well. Safe return. That would be really great."
"Who's Sabitha?"
Locke spoke quietly, directing his inquiry to Chains.
"An ornament to our little gang. Our only young woman, currently away on educational business."
Chains set her glass down beside the one poured to the benefactor and plucked up Locke's glass in exchange.
"Another special deal from your old master. Gifted, my boy, gifted like you are with a preternatural talent for the vexation of others."
"That's us he's talking about," said Carlo. "Pretty soon it'll mean you too,"
Galdo smiled.
"Pipe down, twitlings."
Chains poured a splash of the quicksilver wine into Locke's glass and handed it back to him.
One more toast and prayer. To Locke Lamora, our new brother, my new Pezon. We wish him well. We welcome him warmly. And for him, we pray, wisdom.
With graceful motions, he poured wine for Carlo and Galdo, and then a nearly full glass for himself. Chains and the Sansas raised their glasses. Locke quickly copied them. Silver sparkled under gold.
Welcome to the gentlemen bastards!
Chains tapped his glass gently against Locke's, producing a ringing sound that hung in the air before fading sweetly.
You should have picked death, said Galdo. He did offer you death as a choice, right?
Carlo spoke as he and his brother tapped their own glasses together, then reached across the table in unison to touch Locke's.
Laugh it up, boys.
Soon all the knocking about with glasses was finished, and Chains led the way with a quick sip of his wine.
Ah, mark my words. If this poor little creature lives a year, you two will be his dancing monkeys. He'll throw you grapes whenever he wants to see a trick. Go ahead and have a drink, Locke.
Locke raised the glass. The silvery surface showed him a vivid but wobbly reflection of his own face and the brightly lit room around him. The wine's bouquet was a haze of juniper and anise that tickled his nose. He put the tiny image of himself to his lips and drank. The slightly cool liquor seemed to go two ways at once as he swallowed. A line of tickling warmth ran straight down his throat, while icy tendrils reached upward, sliding across the roof of his mouth and into his sinuses. His eyes bulged. He coughed and ran a hand over his suddenly numb lips.
It's mirror wine from Tal Verar. Good stuff. Now go ahead and eat something, or it'll pop your skull open.
Carlo and Galdo whisked damp cloths off serving platters and bowls, revealing the full extent of the meal for the first time. There were indeed sausages, neatly sliced and fried in oil with quartered pears. There were also split red peppers stuffed with almond paste and spinach, dumplings of thin bread folded over chicken, fried until the bread was as translucent as paper, and cold black beans in wine and mustard sauce. The Sansa brothers were suddenly scooping portions of this and that onto Locke's plate, too fast for him to track. Working awkwardly with a two-pronged silver fork and one of the rounded knives he'd previously scorned, Locke began to shovel things into his mouth. The flavors seemed to burst gloriously, haphazardly. The chicken dumplings were spiced with ginger and ground orange peels. The wine sauce in the bean salad warmed his tongue. The sharp fumes of mustard burned his throat. He found himself gulping wine to put out each new fire as it arose. To his surprise, the Sansa twins didn't partake once they'd served him. They sat with their hands folded, watching Chains. When the older man seemed assured that Locke was eating, he turned to Carlo.
You're a Vardran noble. Let's say you're a liege graf from one of the less important Marrows. You're at a dinner party in Tal Verar. An equal number of men and women with assigned seating. The party is just entering the dining hall. Your assigned lady is beside you as you enter, conversing with you. What do you do?
At a Vardran dinner party, I would hold her chair out for her without invitation.
Carlo didn't smile.
But Verari ladies will stand beside a chair to show they want it pulled out. It's impolite to presume, so I'd let her make the first move.
Very good. Now.
Chains pointed to the second Sansa with one hand as he began adding food to his plate with the other.
What's 17 multiplied by 19?
Galdo closed his eyes in concentration for a few seconds.
323.
Correct. What's the difference between a Vardran Nautical League and a Therin Nautical League?
The Vardran League is 150 yards longer.
Very good.
That's that, then.
Go and eat.
As the Sansa brothers began to undecorously struggle for possession of certain serving dishes, Chains turned to Locke, whose plate was already half empty. After you've been here a few days, I'm going to start asking questions about what you've learned, too. If you want to eat, you'll be expected to learn.
What am I going to learn, other than setting tables?
Everything. Chains looked very pleased with himself. Everything, my boy. How to fight, how to steal, how to lie with a straight face, how to cook meals like this, how to disguise yourself, how to speak like a noble, how to scribe like a priest, how to skulk like a half-wit.
Carlo already knows that one, said Galdo.
Agmo agnamabra,
said Carlo around a mouthful of food. Remember what I said when I told you we didn't work like other thieves work? We're a new sort of thief here, Locke. What we are is actors, false facers. I sit here and pretend to be a priest of Perelandro. For years now, people have been throwing money at me. How do you think I paid to furnish this little fairy burrow, this food? I'm 53. Nobody my age can steal around rooftops and charm locks. I'm better paid for being blind than I ever was for being quick and clever. And now I'm too slow and too round to pass for anything really interesting. Chains finished off the contents of his glass and poured another. But you and Carlo and Galdo and Sabatha, you four will have every advantage I didn't. Your education will be thorough and vigorous. I'll refine my notions, my techniques. When I'm finished, the things you four will pull, well, they'll make my little scam with this temple look simple and unambitious.
That sounds nice, said Locke, who was feeling the wine.
A warm haze of charitable contentment was descending over him and smothering the tension and worry that was so second nature to a Shades Hill orphan.
What do we do first?
Well, tonight, if you're not busy throwing up the first decent meal you've ever had, Carlo and Galdo will draw you a bath. Once you're less aromatic company, you can sleep in. Tomorrow, we'll get you an acolyte's robe, and you can sit the steps with us, taking coins. Tomorrow night, Chains scratched at his beard while he took a sip from his glass, I take you to meet the big man, Kappa Barsavi. He's ever so curious to get a look at you. Chapter 3. Imaginary Men. 1. For the second time in 2 days, Don Lorenzo Salvara found his life interrupted by masked and hooded strangers in an unexpected place. This time it was just after midnight, and they were waiting for him in his study.
"Close the door," said the shorter intruder.
His voice was all Camor, rough and smoky, and clearly accustomed to being obeyed.
"Have a seat, my lord, and don't bother calling for your man. He is indisposed."
"Who the hell are you?" Salvara's sword hand curled reflexively. His belt held no scabbard. He slid the door closed behind him, but made no move to sit at his writing desk.
"How did you get in here?"
The intruder who'd first spoken reached up and pulled down the black cloth that covered his nose and mouth. His face was lean and angular, his hair black, his dark moustache thin and immaculately trimmed. A white scar arced across the man's right cheekbone. He reached into the folds of his well-cut black cloak and pulled out a black leather wallet, which he flipped open so the Don could see its contents, a small crest of gold set inside an intricate design of frosted glass.
"Gods!"
Don Salvara fell into his chair nervously, without further hesitation.
"You're Midnighters!"
"Just so."
The man folded his wallet and put it back in his cloak. The silent intruder, still masked and hooded, moved casually around to stand just a few feet behind Don Lorenzo, between him and the door.
"We apologize for the intrusion, but our business here is extremely sensitive."
Have I somehow offended his grace?"
Not to my knowledge, my Lord Salvara. In fact, you might say we're here to help prevent you from doing so.
What did you say you did to Conte?
Just gave him a little something to help him sleep. We know he's loyal, and we know he's dangerous. We didn't want any misunderstandings.
The man standing at the door punctuated this statement by stepping forward, reaching around Don Salvara, and gently setting Conte's matching fighting knives down on the desktop.
I see. I trust that he'll be well.
Don Salvara drummed his fingers on his writing desk and stared at the scarred intruder.
I should be very displeased otherwise.
He is completely unharmed. I give you my word as the Duke's man.
I shall hold that sufficient for the time being.
The scarred man sighed and rubbed his eyes with two gloved fingers.
There's no need for us to begin like this, my lord. I apologize for the abruptness of our appearance and the manner of our intrusion, but I believe you'll find that your welfare is paramount in our master's eyes. I'm instructed to ask, did you enjoy yourself at the revel today?
Yes.
Don Salvara spoke carefully, as though to a solicitor or a court recorder. I suppose that would be an accurate assessment.
Good, good. You had company, didn't you?
The Doña Sofia was with me.
I refer to someone else, not one of His Grace's subjects, not Camori.
Ah, the merchant. A merchant named Lucas Fairwhite from Emberlane.
From Emberlane, of course.
The scarred man folded his arms and looked around the Don's study. He stared for a moment at a pair of small glass portraits of the old Don and Doña Salvara, set in a frame decked with black velvet funeral ribbons.
Well, that man is no more a merchant of Emberlane than you or I, my Lord Salvara. He's a fraud, a sham.
Don
Salvara nearly jumped to his feet, but remembered the man standing behind him and seemed to think better of it.
I don't see how that could be possible. He...
Beg pardon, my lord.
The scarred man smiled, gruesomely and artificially, as a man without children might smile when trying to comfort an upset babe.
But let me ask you, have you ever heard of the man they call the Thorn of Camor?
2. I only steal because my dear old family needs the money to live.
Locke Lamora made this proclamation with his wineglass held high. He and the other gentleman bastards were seated at the old witchwood table in the opulent burrow beneath the house of Perelandro. Carlo and Galdo on his right, Jean and Bug on his left. A huge spread of food was set before them, and the celestial chandelier swung overhead with its familiar golden light. The others began to jeer.
Liar, they chorused in unison. I only steal because this wicked world won't let me work an honest trade,
Carlo cried, hoisting his own glass.
Liar! I only steal because I have to support my poor lazy twin brother, whose indolence broke our mother's heart.
Galdo elbowed Carlo as he made this announcement.
Liar!
I only steal, said Jean, because I've temporarily fallen in with bad company.
Liar!
At last the ritual came to Bug. The boy raised his glass a bit shakily and yelled,
I only steal because it's heaps of fucking fun!
Bastard!
With a general clamour of whooping and hollering, the five thieves banged glasses together. Light glittered on crystal and shone through the misty green depths of Verrari mint wine. The four men drained their glasses in one go and slammed them back down on the tabletop. Bug, already a bit cross-eyed, handled his somewhat more delicately.
Gentlemen, I hold in my hands the first fruits of all our long weeks of study and suffering.
Locke held up a rolled parchment embossed with ribbons and a blue wax seal, the colour of the lesser nobility of Camor. "A letter of credit for 5,000 full crowns, to be drawn tomorrow against Don Salvara's funds at Maraggio's, and, I dare say, the first score our youngest member has ever helped us to bring in." "Barrel boy!" the Sansa brothers hollered in unison. A moment later a small almond-crusted bread roll arced from between their seats, hit Bug right between the eyes, and plopped down onto his empty plate. Bug tore it in half and responded in kind, aiming well despite his wobbliness. Locke continued, speaking as Carlo scowled and rubbed crumbs out of his eyes. "Second touch this afternoon was easy, but we wouldn't have gotten so far so fast if not for Bug's quick action yesterday. What a stupid, reckless, idiotic, ridiculous damn thing to do! I haven't the words to express my admiration." Locke had managed to work a bit of wine bottle legerdemain while speaking. The empty glasses were suddenly full. "To Bug, the new bane of the Camor City Watch!" When the cheering and the guzzling from this toast had subsided, and Bug had been smacked upon the back often enough to turn the contents of his skull sideways, Locke produced a single large glass, set it in the middle of the table, and filled it slowly. "Just one thing more before we can eat." He held the glass up as the others fell silent. "A glass poured to air for an absent friend. We miss old Chains terribly, and we wish his soul peace. May the crooked warden ever stand watch and bless his crooked servant. He was a good and penitent man in the manner of our kind." Gently, Locke set the glass in the centre of the table and covered it with a small black cloth. "He would have been very proud of you, Bug."
"I do hope so."
The boy stared at the covered glass in the middle of the opulent glassware and gilded cookery.
"I wish I could have met him."
"You would have been a restful project for his old age." Jean kissed the back of his own left hand, the benedictory gesture of the nameless 13th's priesthood. "A very welcome respite from what he endured raising the four of us."
"Jean's being generous. He and I were saints. It's the Sansa brothers that kept the poor old bastard up late praying 6 nights out of 7.
Locke reached out toward one cloth-covered platter.
"Let's eat. Praying that you and Jean would grow up quick and handsome like the two of us, you mean?"
Galdo's hand darted out and caught Locke's at the wrist.
"Aren't you forgetting something?"
"Am I?" Carlo, Galdo, and Jean met this question with a coordinated stare. Bug looked sheepish and gazed up at the chandelier.
"Gods damn it!"
Locke slid out of his gold-gilded chair and went to a side cupboard. When he returned to the table, he had a tiny sampling glass in his hand, little more than a thimble for liquor. Into this he let slip the smallest dash of mint wine. He didn't hold his glass up, but pushed it into the centre of the table beside the glass under the black cloth.
"A glass poured in air for an absent someone. I don't know where she is at the moment, and I pray you all choke save Bug. Thanks very fucking much."
"Hardly a graceful blessing, especially for a priest."
Carlo kissed the back of his own left hand and waved it over the tiny glass.
"She was one of us even before you were, Garista."
"You know what I do pray?" Locke set his hands on the edge of the table, his knuckles rapidly turning white.
"That maybe some day one of you finds out what love is when it travels farther up than the buttons of your trousers." "It takes two to break a heart."
Galdo gently placed his left hand over Locke's right.
"I don't recall her fucking things up without your able assistance."
"And I dare say," said Carlo, "that it would be a tremendous relief to us all if you would just have the courtesy to go out and get yourself wenched, long and hard. Gods, do three at once. It's not as though we don't have the funds."
I'll have you know my patience for this topic was exhausted long before...
Locke's voice was rising to a shout when Jean grabbed him firmly by his left biceps. Jean's fist wrapped easily all the way around Locke's arm.
She was our good friend, Locke. Was and still is. You owe her something a bit more godly than that.
Jean reached out for the wine bottle, then filled the little glass to its brim. He raised it into the light and took his other hand off Locke's arm.
A glass poured to air for an absent friend. We wish Sabbatha well. For ourselves, we pray brotherhood.
Locke stared at him for a second that seemed like minutes, then let out a long sigh.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to ruin the occasion. That was a poor toast, and I repent it. I should have thought better of my responsibilities.
I'm sorry, too. Galdo grinned sheepishly. We don't blame you for the way you feel. We know she was...
Her?
Well, I'm not sorry about the wenching bit.
Carlo shrugged in mock apology.
I'm fucking serious, man. Dip your wick. Drop your anchor. Go see a lady about a sheath for a dagger. You'll feel better.
Isn't it obvious that I'm just ecstatic right now? I don't need to feel better, because you and I still have work to do this evening. For the love of the crooked warden, can we please just kill this subject and throw its godsdamned corpse in the bay?
Sorry, Carlo said after a few seconds and a well-aimed glare from Jean.
Sorry. Look, you know we mean well. We're both sorry if we push. But she's in parley and we're in Camor, and it's obvious you...
Carlo would have said something else, but an almond roll bounced off the bridge of his nose, and he flinched in surprise. Another roll hit Galdo in the forehead. One arced into Jean's lap, and Locke managed to throw up a hand in time to swat down the one intended for him.
Honestly!
Bug clutched still more rolls in his outstretched hands, and he pointed them like loaded crossbows.
Is this what I get to look forward to when I grow up? I thought we were celebrating being richer and cleverer than everyone else.
Locke looked at the boy for just a moment, then reached out and took the full sampling glass from Jean, a smile breaking out as he did so.
Bug's right. Let's cut the shit and have dinner.
He raised the glass as high as he could toward the light of the chandelier.
To us, richer and cleverer than everyone else. Richer and cleverer than everyone else, came the echoing chorus. We toast absent friends who helped to bring us to where we are now. We do miss them.
Locke set the little glass to his lips and took a minuscule sip before he set it back down.
And we love them still, he added quietly.
3.
The Thorn of Camor. It's a particularly ridiculous rumour that floats around the dining parlour when some of the more excitable dons don't water their wine quite thoroughly enough.
The Thorn of Camor, said the scarred man pleasantly, walked off your pleasure barge early this evening with a signed note for 5,000 of your white iron crowns.
Who? Lucas Fairwhite?
None other.
Lucas Fairwhite is a Vadran. My mother was Vadran. I know the tongue. Lucas is old Emberlane all the way through. He covers himself in wool and flinches back 6 feet any time a woman blinks at him.
Don Lorenzo pulled his optics off in irritation and set them on his desk.
The man would bet the lives of his own children against the price he could get for barrels of herring guts on any given morning. I've dealt with his kind too many times to count. That man is no Camori, and he is no mythical thief.
My lord, you are 24, yes?
For the time being, is that quite relevant?
You have no doubt known many merchants in the years since your mother and father passed away. May they have the peace of the long silence. Many merchants, and many of them Vadrans, correct?
Quite correct.
And if a man, a very clever man,
wishes you to think him a merchant, well, what would he dress up and present himself as? A fisherman? A mercenary archer?
I don't grasp your meaning.
I mean, my lord Salvara, that your own expectations have been used against you. You have a keen sense for men of business, surely. You've grown your family fortune several times over in your brief time handling it. Therefore, a man who wished to snare you in some scheme could do nothing wiser than to act the consummate man of business, to deliberately manifest all of your expectations, to show you exactly what you expected and desired to see.
It seems to me that if I accept your argument, the Don said slowly, then the self-evident truth of any legitimate thing could be taken as grounds for its falseness. I say Lucas Fairwhite is a merchant of Emberlane because he shows the signs of being so. You say those same signs are what prove him counterfeit. I need more sensible evidence than this.
Let me digress then, my lord, and ask another question.
The scarred man drew his hands within the black folds of his cloak and stared down at the young nobleman.
If you were a thief who preyed exclusively on the nobility of our serene Duchy of Camor, how would you hide your actions?
Exclusively? Your Thorn of Camor again. There can't be any such thief. There are arrangements, the secret peace. Other thieves would take care of the matter as soon as any man dared breach the peace.
And if our thief could evade capture, if our thief could conceal his identity from his fellows?
If. They say the Thorn of Camor steals from the rich.
Don Salvara placed a hand on his own chest, and gives every last copper to the poor. But have you heard of any bags of gold being dumped in the street in Catchfire lately? Any charcoal burners or knackers suddenly walking around in silk waistcoats and embroidered boots? Please. The Thorn is a commoner's ale tale. Master swordsman, romancer of ladies, a ghost who walks through walls. Ridiculous!
Your doors are locked and all your windows are barred. Yet here we are in your study, my lord.
Granted, but you're men of flesh and blood.
So it's said. We're getting off the subject. Our thief, my lord, would trust you and your peers to keep his activities concealed for him. Hypothetically speaking, if Lucas Fairwhite were the Thorn of Camor, and you knew that he had strolled off with a small fortune from your coffers, what would you do? Would you rouse the watch, cry for aid openly in the court of his grace, speak of the matter in front of Don Paleri Jacopo?
That's an interesting point. I wonder...
Would you want the entire city to know that you'd been taken in? That you'd been tricked? Would men of business ever trust your judgment again? Would your reputation ever truly recover?
I suppose it would be a very difficult thing.
The scarred man's right hand reappeared, gloveless and pale against the darkness of the cloak, one finger pointing outward.
Her ladyship, the Doña Rosalina de Mare, lost 10,000 crowns 4 years ago in exchange for titles to upriver orchards that don't exist.
A second finger curled outward.
Don and Doña Felucia lost twice as much 2 years ago. They thought they were financing a coup in Talisham that would have made the city a family estate. Last year, the scarred man said as a third finger unfolded, Don Javaris paid 15,000 full crowns to a soothsayer who claimed to be able to restore the old man's firstborn son to life.
The man's little finger snapped out, and he waved his extended hand at Don Lorenzo.
"Now we have the Don and Doña Salvara involved in a secret business deal that is both tempting and convenient. Tell me, have you ever heard of the troubles of the lords and ladies I have named?"
"No."
"Doña Damare visits your wife in her garden twice weekly. They discuss alchemical botany together. You've played cards with the sons of Don Javaris many times. And yet this is all a surprise to you?"
"Yes, quite, I assure you."
"It was a surprise to His Grace as well. My master has spent 4 years attempting to follow the slender threads of evidence connecting these crimes, my lord. A fortune the size of your own vanished into thin air, and it took ducal orders to pry open the lips of the wronged parties, because their pride compelled their silence."
Don Lorenzo stared at the surface of his desk for a long moment.
"Fairwhite has a suite at the Tumble home. He has a manservant, superior clothes, 100-crown optics. He has proprietary secrets of the House of Bel-Oster."
Don Salvara looked up at the scarred man as though presenting a difficult problem to a demanding tutor.
"Things that no thief could have." "Would fine clothes be beyond the means of a man with more than 40,000 stolen crowns at his command? And his cask of unaged brandy. How would you or I or any other man outside the House of Bel-Oster know what it should look like, or what it should taste like? It's a simple fraud."
"He was recognized on the street by a solicitor, one of the Razona law scribes who sticks to the walls at Maraggio's."
"Of course he was, because he began building the identity of Lucas Fairwhite long ago, probably before he ever met Doña Damare. He has a very real account at Maraggio's, opened with real money 5 years ago. He has every outward flourish that a man in his position should bear. But Lucas Fairwhite is a ghost, a lie, a stage role performed for a very select private audience. I have tracked him for months."
"We are sensible people, Sophia and I. Surely we would have seen something out of place."
"Out of place? The entire affair has been out of place. My Lord Salvara, I implore you, hear me carefully. You are a financier of fine liquors. You say a prayer to your mother's shade each week at a Vadran temple. What a fascinating coincidence that you should chance upon a needy Vadran who happens to be a dealer in the same field, eh?"
"Where else but the Temple of Fortunate Waters would a Vadran pray while visiting Camor?"
"Nowhere, of course. But look at the coincidences piling heavily upon one another. A Vadran liquor merchant in need of rescue, and he just so happens to be on his way to visit Don Jacopo, your blood enemy, a man that everyone knows you would crush by any means the Duke hadn't forbidden you."
"Were you observing us when I first met him?"
"Yes, very carefully. We saw you and your man approach that alley to rescue a man you thought to be in danger. We
thought he was being strangled."
"Was he? The men in those masks were his accomplices, my lord. The fight was staged. It was a means to introduce you to the imaginary merchant and his imaginary opportunity. Everything you value was used to bait the trap. Your sympathies for Vadrans, your sense of duty, your courage, your interest in fine liquors, your desire to best Don Jacobo. And can it be a coincidence that Fairwhite's scheme must be secret, that it runs on an extremely short and demanding schedule, that it just happens to feed your every known ambition?"
The Don stared at the far wall of his study, tapping his fingers against his desk at a gradually increasing tempo.
"This is quite a shock," he said at last, in a small voice without any fight left in it.
"Forgive me for that, my Lord Salvara. The truth is unfortunate. Of course, the Thorn of Camor isn't 10 feet tall. Of course, he can't walk through walls. But he is a very real thief. He is posing as a Vadran named Lucas Fairwhite, and he does have 5,000 crowns of your money, with an eye for 20,000 more.
I must send men to Maraggio's, so he can't exchange my note in the morning," said Don Lorenzo.
"Respectfully, my lord, you must do nothing of the sort. My instructions are clear. We don't just want the Thorn. We want his accomplices, his contacts, his sources of information, his entire network of thieves and spies. We have him in the open now, and we can follow him as he goes about his business. One hint that his game is unmasked, and he will bolt. The opportunity we have may never present itself again. His Grace Duke Nicovante is quite adamant that everyone involved in these crimes must be identified and taken. Toward that end, your absolute cooperation is requested and required in the Duke's name."
"What am I to do, then?"
"Continue to act as though you are entirely taken in by Fairwhite's story. Let him exchange the note. Let him taste some success. And when he returns to you asking for more money..."
"Yes?"
"Why, give it to him, my lord. Give him everything he asks."
4. Once the dinner dishes were cleared away, and a tipsy bug was given the task of setting them a-sparkle with warm water and white sand...
"Excellent for your moral education," Jean had cried as he'd heaped up the porcelain and crystal.
Locke and Carlo withdrew to the burrow's wardrobe to begin preparations for the third and most critical touch of the Don Salvara game. The elderglass cellar beneath the house of Perelandro was divided into 3 areas. One of them was the kitchen, another was split into sleeping quarters with wooden partitions, and the third was referred to as the wardrobe. Long clothes racks stretched across every wall of the wardrobe, holding hundreds of pieces of costuming organized by origin, by season, by cut, by size, and by social class. There were sackcloth robes, laborers' tunics, and butchers' aprons with dried bloodstains. There were cloaks of winter weight and summer weight, cheaply woven and finely tailored, unadorned or decorated with everything up to precious metal trim and peacock feathers. There were robes and accessories for most of the Therin priestly orders, Perelandro, Morgante, Nara, Sendovani, Iono, and so forth. There were silk blouses and cunningly armored doublets, gloves and ties and cravats, enough canes and walking sticks to outfit a mercenary company of hobbled old men. Chains had started this collection more than 20 years before, and his students had added to it with the wealth gained from years of schemes. Very little worn by the gentleman bastards went to waste. Even the foulest-smelling, sweat-soaked summer garments were washed and dusted with alchemical pomanders and hung carefully. They could always be fouled up again, if needed. A man-height looking-glass dominated the heart of the wardrobe. Another, much smaller glass hung from a sort of pulley system on the ceiling, so that it could be moved around and positioned as necessary. Locke stood before the larger mirror dressed in matching doublet and breeches of midnight velvet. His hose was the scarlet of blood in sunset waters, and his simple Camori tie was a near match.
"Is this bloody melodrama really such a good idea?"
Carlo was dressed quite similarly, though his hose and his accents were grey. He pulled his tunic sleeves back above his elbows and fastened them there with black pearl clips.
"It's a fine idea," Locke said, adjusting his tie. "We're midnighters. We're full of ourselves. What sort of self-respecting spy would break into a manor house in darkest night wearing green or orange or white?"
"The sort that walked up and knocked at the door would."
I appreciate that, but I still don't want to change the plan. Don Salvara's had a busy day. He'll be wide open for a nice shock at the end of it. Can't shock him quite the same in Lavender and Carmine.
Well, certainly not in the way you're thinking, no.
This doublet's damned uncomfortable in the back, Locke muttered. Jean!
Jean!
What is it? Came an echoing return shout a long moment later.
Why, I'd just love to say your name! Get in here!
Jean ambled into the wardrobe a moment later, a glass of brandy in one hand and a battered book in the other.
I thought Graumann had the night off for this bit, he said.
He does. Locke gestured impatiently at the back of his doublet. I need the services of Camor's ugliest seamstress.
Galdo's helping Bug wash up. Grab your needles, glass eyes.
Jean's eyebrows drew down above his reading optics, but he set down his book and his glass and opened a small wooden chest set against one of the wardrobe walls.
What are you reading?
Carlo had added a tiny silver and amethyst clip to the centre of his tie and was examining himself in the small glass approvingly.
Kim Larthen,
Jean replied, working black thread through a white bone needle and trying not to prick his fingers.
The Corish romances? Locke snorted. Sentimental crap. Never knew you had a taste for fairy stories.
They happen to be culturally significant records of the Therin throne's centuries, Jean said, as he stepped behind Locke, seam ripper in one hand and threaded needle in the other. Plus at least three knights get their heads torn completely off by the beast of Wuatso.
Illustrated manuscript, by chance?
Not the good parts, no. Jean fiddled with the back of the doublet as delicately as he'd ever charmed a lock or a victim's coat pocket.
Oh, just let it out. I don't care how it looks. It'll be hidden in the back of my cloak anyway. We can pretty it up later.
We? Jean snorted as he loosened the doublet with a few strategic rips and slashes. Me, more like. You mend clothes like dogs write poetry.
And I readily admit it. Oh, gods, much better. Now there's room to hide the sigil wallet and a few surprises, just in case.
It feels odd to be letting something out for you rather than taking it in. Jean arranged his tools as he'd found them in the sewing chest and closed it back up.
Do mind your training. We wouldn't want you gaining half a pound.
Well, most of me is brain weight. Locke folded his own tunic sleeves back and pinned them up as Carlo had.
You're one-third bad intentions, one-third pure avarice, and one-eighth sawdust.
What's left, I'll credit, must be brains.
Well, since you're here and you're such an expert on my poor self, why don't you pull out the mask box and help me with my face?
Jean paused for a sip from his brandy glass before pulling out a tall, battered wooden box inset with many dozens of small drawers.
What do we want to do first? Your hair? You're going black, right?
As pitch. I should only have to be this fellow two or three times. Jean twirled a white cloth around the shoulders of Locke's doublet and fastened it in front with a tiny bone clasp. He then opened a poultice jar and smeared his fingers with the contents, a firm dark gel that smelled richly of citrus.
Looks like charcoal and smells like oranges. I'll never fathom Jessaline's sense of humour.
Locke smiled as Jean began to knead the stuff into his brown hair.
Even a black apothecary needs to stay amused somehow. Remember that beef-scented knockout candle she gave us to deal with Don Felucia's damn guard dog?
Very droll, that. Carlo frowned as he made further minute adjustments to his own finery.
Stray cats running from every corner of Camor at the scent, dropping in their tracks until the street was full of little bodies. Wind shifting all over the place, and all of us running around trying to stay ahead of the smoke.
Not our finest moment, said Jean. His job was already nearly finished, The stuff seemed to sink into Locke's hair, imparting a natural-looking shade of deep Camorri black, with only the slightest sheen. But many men in Camorre used slick substances to hold or perfume their hair. This would hardly be noteworthy. Jean wiped his fingers on Locke's white neck towel, then dipped a scrap of cloth into another poultice jar containing a pearly gel. This stuff, when applied to his fingers, cleared the residue of hair dye away as though the black gel were evaporating into thin air. Jean dabbed the cloth at Locke's temples and neck, erasing the faint smudges and drips left over from the colouring process.
"Scar?" Jean asked when he was finished. "Please." Locke ran his little finger across the line of his right cheekbone. "Slash right across there, if you would."
Jean withdrew a slender wooden tube with a chalky white tip from the mask box and drew a short line on Locke's face with it, just as Locke had indicated. Locke flinched as the stuff sizzled for a second or two. In the blink of an eye, the white line hardened into a raised, pale arc of pseudo-skin, perfectly mimicking a scar. Bug appeared through the wardrobe door at that instant, his cheeks a bit ruddier than usual. In one hand he held a black leather folding wallet, slightly larger than that which a gentleman would ordinarily carry.
"Kitchen's clean! Galdo said you'd forget this if I didn't bring it in and throw it at you."
"Please don't take him literally." Locke held out a hand for the wallet while Jean removed the white cloth from his shoulders, satisfied that the hair dye was dry.
"Break that thing and I'll roll you to Emberlane in a barrel, personally."
The sigil inside the wallet, the intricate confection of gold and crystal and frosted glass, was by far the most expensive prop of the whole game. Even the 502 cask of Osterschalen had been cheaper. The sigil had been crafted in Talisham, 4 days' ride down the coast to the south. No Camorri counterfeiter, regardless of skill, could be trusted to be quiet or comfortable about mimicking the badge of the Duke's own secret police. A stylized spider over the royal seal of the Serene Duchy. None of the gentleman bastards had ever seen one, but Locke was confident that few of the lesser nobility had either. The rough description of the dreaded sigil was whispered by the right people of Camorre, and from that description a best-guess forgery had been put together.
"Durant the Gimp says that the spider's just bullshit," said Bug as he handed over the wallet.
All three older gentleman bastards in the room looked at him sharply.
"If you put Durant's brains in a thimbleful of water," said Jean, "they'd look like a ship lost in the middle of the sea."
"The Midnighters are real, Bug." Locke patted his hair gingerly and found that his hands came away clean.
"If you're ever found breaching the peace, you'd better pray the Kappa gets to you before they do. Barsavi's the soul of mercy compared to the man that runs the Palace of Patience."
"I know the Midnighters are real," said Bug. "I just said there's some that say the spider is bullshit."
"Oh, he exists.
Jean, pick out a moustache for me. Something that goes with this hair." Locke ran a finger over the smooth skin around his lips, shaved just after dinner.
"There's a man behind the Midnighters. Jean and I have spent years trying to figure out which of the Duke's court it must be, but all the leads go nowhere in the end."
"Even Galdo and I are stumped," added Carlo. "So you know we're dealing with a devil of singular subtlety."
"How can you be sure, though?"
"Let me put it like this, Bug."
Locke paused while Jean held up a false moustache. Locke shook his head and Jean went back to digging in the mask box.
"When Kappa Barsavi does for someone, we hear about it, right? We have connections and the word gets passed. The Kappa wants people to know his reasons. It avoids future trouble, makes an example."
"And when the Duke does for someone himself," said Carlo, "there's always signs. Yellow jackets, night glass soldiers, writs, trials, proclamations."
"But when the spider puts the finger on someone..."
Locke gave a brief nod of approval to the second moustache Jean held up for consideration.
"When it's the spider, the poor bastard in question falls right off the face of the world, and Kappa Barsavi doesn't say a thing. Do you understand?
He pretends that nothing has happened. So when you grasp that Barsavi doesn't fear the Duke, looks down on him quite a bit, actually, well, it follows that there's someone out there who does make him wet his breeches.
Oh, you mean other than the Grey King?
Carlo snorted.
This Grey King mess will be over in a few months, Bug. One lone madman against 3,000 knives, all answering to Barsavi. The Grey King is a walking corpse. The spider isn't so easily gotten rid of.
Which, said Locke, is exactly why we're hoping to see Don Salvara jump 6 feet in the air when he finds us waiting in his study. Because the Blue Bloods are no more comfortable with surprise visits from Midnighters than we are.
I hate to interrupt, said Jean, but did you shave this time?
Ah, good. With a small stick, he applied a glistening smear of transparent paste to Locke's upper lip. Locke wrinkled his nose in disgust. With a few quick finger motions, Jean placed the false moustache and pressed it home. In a second or two, it was set there as firmly as if it had grown naturally.
This gum is made from the inner hide of a wolf shark,
Jean explained for Bug's sake. And last time we used it, we forgot to pick up some of the dissolving spirit.
And I had to get rid of the moustache in a hurry, said Locke. And damned if he didn't scream when Jean did the honours, said Carlo.
Like a Sansa brother in an empty whorehouse. Locke made a rude gesture at Carlo. Carlo mimed aiming and loosing a crossbow at him in return.
Scar, moustache, hair, are we done here?
Jean packed the last of the disguise implements away in the mask box.
That should do it, yes.
Locke stared at his reflection in the large mirror for a moment, and when he spoke next his voice had altered, subtly deeper, slightly rougher. His intonation was the bored humorlessness of a watch sergeant dressing down a petty offender for the 1,000th time in his career.
Let's go tell a man he's got himself a problem with some thieves.
5. So, said Don Lorenzo Salvara, you wish me to continue deliberately granting promissory notes to a man that you describe as the most capable thief in Camor?
Respectfully, my lord Salvara, that's what you would have done anyway, even without our intervention.
When Locke spoke, there was no hint of Lucas Fairwhite in his voice or in his mannerisms. There was no trace of the Vardran merchant's restrained energy or stuffy dignity. This new fiction had the fictional backing of the Duke's incontrovertible writ. He was the sort of man who could and would tease a Don while invading the sanctity of that Don's home. Such audacity could never be faked. Locke had to feel it, summon it from somewhere inside, cloak himself in arrogance as though it were an old familiar garment. Locke Lamora became a shadow in his own mind. He was a Midnighter, an officer in the Duke's silent constabulary. Locke's complicated lies were this new man's simple truth.
The sums discussed could easily total half my available holdings.
Then give our friend Fairwhite half your fortune, my lord. Choke the thorn on exactly what he desires. Promissory notes will tie him down, keep him moving back and forth between counting houses.
Counting houses that will throw my very real money after this phantom, you mean?
Yes, in the service of the Duke, no less. Take heart, my lord Salvara. His Grace is entirely capable of compensating you for any loss you incur while aiding us in the capture of this man. In my opinion, though, the thorn will have time to neither spend it nor move it very far. So your stolen money should be recovered before that even becomes necessary. You must also consider the aspects of the situation that are not strictly financial.
Meaning?
His Grace's gratitude for your assistance in bringing this matter to our desired outcome, said Locke, balanced against his certain displeasure if any reluctance on your part should alert our thief to the net drawing tight around him.
Ah,
Don Salvara picked his optics up and resettled them on his nose. With that, I can hardly argue.
I will not be able to speak to you in public. No uniformed member of the Camor Watch will approach you for any reason related to this affair. If I speak to you at all, it must be at night, in secret.
Am I to tell Conte to keep refreshments at hand for men coming in through the windows? Shall I tell the Doña Sofia to send any midnighters to my study if they should pop out of her wardrobe closet?
I give you my word. Any future appearances will be less alarming, my lord. My instructions were to impress upon you the seriousness of the situation and the full extent of our ability to bypass obstacles. I assure you, I have no personal desire to antagonize you any further. Resecuring your fortune will be the capstone to many months of hard work on my part.
And the Doña Sofia? Has your master dictated a part for her in this counter-charade?
Your wife is a most extraordinary woman. By all means, inform her of our involvement. Tell her the truth about Lucas Fairwhite. Enlist her very capable aid in our endeavor. However,
Locke said, grinning malignantly,
I do believe that I shall regretfully leave you the task of explaining this to her on your own, my lord.
6. On the landward side of Camor, armed men pace the old stone walls of the city, ever vigilant for signs of bandits or hostile armies in the field. On the seaward side, watchtowers and war galleys serve the same purpose. At the guard stations on the periphery of the Alchigrante district, the city watch stands ready to protect the city's lesser nobility from the annoyance of having to see or smell any of their actual subjects against their wishes. Locke and Carlo crossed the Angevine just before midnight on the broad glass bridge called the Eldrin Arch. This ornately carved span connected the western Alchigrante with the lush semi-public gardens of Two Silver Green, another spot where the insufficiently well-heeled were discouraged from lingering, often with whips and batons. Tall cylinders of ruby-coloured glass shed alchemical light onto the wispy threads of mist that curled and wavered below the knees of their horses. The centre of the bridge was 50 feet above the water, and the usual night fog reached no higher. The red lamps swayed gently within their black iron frames as the muggy hangman's breeze spun them, and the two gentlemen bastards rode down into the Alchigrante with that eerie light surrounding them like a bloody aura.
"Hold there! State your name and business!"
At the point where the bridge met the Angevine's north shore, there was a low wooden shack with oil-paper windows, through which a pale white glow emanated. A single figure stood beside it, his yellow tabard turned to orange in the light of the bridge lamps. The speaker's words might have been bold, but his voice was young and a little uncertain. Locke smiled. The Alchigrante guard shacks always held two yellow jackets, but at this one the more senior had clearly sent his less hardened partner out into the fog to do the actual work. So much the better. Locke pulled his precious sigil wallet out of his black cloak as his horse cantered down beside the guard station.
"My name is immaterial."
Locke flipped the wallet open to allow the round-faced young city watchman a glimpse of the sigil by the light of his guard station.
"My business is that of His Grace, Duke Nicovante."
"I see, sir."
"I never came this way. We did not speak. Be sure that your fellow watchman understands this as well."
The yellow jacket bowed and took a quick step backward, as though afraid to stay too close. Locke smiled. Black-cloaked riders on black horses looming out of darkness and mist. It was easy to laugh at such conceits in full daylight, but night had a way of lending weight to phantasms. If Coin-Kisser's Row was where Camor's money was put to use, the Alchigrante district was where it was put to rest. It was four connected islands, each a sort of tiered hill sloping up to the base of the plateau that held the five towers. Old money and new money mingled crazy quilt fashion here in mazes of manor houses and private gardens. Here the merchants and money changers and shipbrokers looked down comfortably on the rest of the city. Here the lesser nobility looked up covetously at the towers of the five families who ruled all. Carriages clattered past from time to time, their black lacquered wooden cabins trailing bobbing lanterns and banners, proclaiming the arms of whoever travelled within. Some of these were guarded by teams of armed outriders in slashed doublets and polished breastplates, this year's fashion for rented thugs. A few teams of horses wore harnesses spotted with miniature alchemical lights. These appeared at a distance, looking like chains of fireflies bobbing in the mist. Don Salvara's manor was a four-story pillared rectangle, several centuries old and sagging a bit under the weight of its years, for it had been built entirely by human hands. It was a sort of island unto itself at the heart of the Isla Durona, westernmost neighbourhood of the Altagrande, surrounded on all sides by a 12-foot stone wall and enclosed by thick gardens. It shared no party walls with neighbouring manors. Amber lights burned behind the barred windows on the third floor. Locke and Carlo quietly dismounted in the alley adjacent to the manor's northern wall. Several long nights of careful reconnaissance by Locke and Bug had revealed the easiest routes over the alley wall and up the side of the Salvara manor. Dressed as they were, hidden by mist and darkness, they would be effectively invisible as soon as they could hop the outer wall and get off the street. A moment of fortunate stillness fell upon them as Carlo tied the horses to a weathered wooden post beside the garden wall. Not a soul was in sight. Carlo stroked his horse's thin mane.
"Hoist a glass or two in memory of us if we don't come back, love."
Locke put his back against the base of the wall and cupped his hands. Carlo set a foot in this makeshift stirrup and leapt upward, propelled by the mingled strength of his legs and Locke's arms. When he'd hoisted himself quietly and carefully atop the wall, he reached back down with both arms to hoist Locke up. The Sansa twin was as wiry as Locke was slender, and the operation went smoothly. In seconds they were both down in the wet, fragrant darkness of the garden, crouched motionless, listening. The doors on the ground floor were all protected from within by intricate clockwork fail-safes and steel bars. They simply could not be picked. But the rooftop, well, those who weren't yet important enough to live with the constant threat of assassination, often placed an inordinate degree of faith in high walls. The two thieves went up the north face of the manor house, slowly and carefully, wedging hands and feet firmly into chinks in the warm, slick stone. The first and second floors were dark and quiet. The light on the third floor was on the opposite side of the building. Hearts hammering with excitement, they hauled themselves up until they were just beneath the parapet of the roof, where they paused for a long interval, straining to catch at any sound from within the manor that would hint at discovery. The moons were stuffed away behind gauzy grey clouds. On their left, the city was an arc of blurred jewel lights shining through mist, and above them the impossible heights of the five towers stood like black shadows before the sky. The threads of light that burned on their parapets and in their windows enhanced rather than reduced their aura of menace. Staring up at them from near the ground was a sure recipe for vertigo. Locke was the first over the parapet. Peering intently by the faint light falling from above, he planted his feet on a white-tiled pathway in the centre of the roof and kept them there. He was surrounded on either side by the dark shapes of bushes, blossoms, small trees and vines. The roof was rich with the scent of vegetation and night soil. The street-level garden was a mundane affair, if well tended. This was the Doña Sofia's private botanical preserve. Most alchemical botanists, in Locke's experience, were enthusiasts of bizarre poisons. He made sure his hood and cloak were cinched tight around him and pulled his black neckcloth up over his lower face. Soft stepping along the white path, Locke and Carlo threaded their way through Sophia's garden, more carefully than if they had been walking between streams of lamp oil with their cloaks on fire. At the garden's centre was a roof hatch with a simple tumbler lock. Carlo listened carefully at this door for 2 minutes with his favorite picks poised in his hands. Charming the lock took less than 10 seconds. The fourth floor. Doña Sofia's workshop. A place where the two intruders wanted even less to stumble or linger than they had in her garden. Quiet as guilty husbands coming home from a late night of drinking, they stole through the dark rooms of laboratory apparatus and potted plants, scampering for the narrow stone stairs that led downward to a side passage on the third floor. The operations of the Salvara household were well known to the gentleman bastards. The Don and Doña kept their private chambers on the third floor, across the hall from the Don's study. The second floor was the Sola, a reception and dining hall that went mostly disused when the couple had no friends over to entertain. The first floor held the kitchen, several parlors, and the servants' quarters. In addition to Conte, the Salvaras kept a pair of middle-aged housekeepers, a cook, and a young boy who served as a messenger and scullion. All of them would be asleep on the first floor. None of them posed even a fraction of a threat that Conte did. This was the part of the scheme that couldn't be planned with any precision. They had to locate the old soldier and deal with him before they could have their intended conversation with Don Salvara. Footsteps echoed from somewhere else on the floor. Locke, in the lead, crouched low and peeked around the left-hand corner. It turned out he was looking down the long passage that divided the third floor in half lengthwise. Don Salvara had left the door to his study open and was vanishing into the bedchamber. That door he closed firmly behind him, and a moment later the sound of a metal lock echoed down the hall.
"Serendipity," whispered Locke. "I suspect he'll be busy for quite some time in there. Light's still on in his study, so we know he's coming back out. Let's get the hard part over with."
Locke and Carlo slipped down the hallway, sweating now, but barely letting their heavy cloaks flutter as they moved. The long passage was tastefully decorated with hanging tapestries and shallow wall sconces in which tiny glow-glasses shed no more light than that of smouldering coals. Behind the heavy doors to the Salvara's chambers, someone laughed. The stairwell at the far end of the passage was wide and circular. Steps of white marble, inset with mosaic tile maps of Camor, spiraled down into the solar. Here Carlo grabbed Locke by one sleeve, put a finger to his lips, and jerked his head downward.
"Listen,"
he murmured. Clang, clang. Footsteps. Clang, clang. This sequence of noises was repeated several times, growing slightly louder each time. Locke grinned at Carlo. Someone was pacing the solar, methodically checking the locks and the iron bars guarding each window. At this time of the night, there was only one man in the house who'd be doing such a thing. Carlo knelt beside the balustrade, just to the left of the top of the staircase. Anyone coming up the spiral stairs would have to pass directly beneath this position. He reached inside his cloak and took out a folded leather sack and a length of narrow-gauge rope woven from black silk. He then began to thread the silk line through and around the sack in some arcane fashion that Locke couldn't follow. Locke knelt just behind Carlo and kept one eye on the long passage they'd come down. A reappearance of the Don was hardly likely yet, but the benefactor was said to make colourful examples of incautious thieves. Conte's light, steady footsteps echoed on the staircase beneath them. In a fair fight, the Don's man would almost certainly paint the walls with Locke and Carlo's blood, so it stood to reason that this fight would have to be as unfair as possible. At the moment the top of Conte's bald head appeared beneath him, Carlo reached out between the balustrade posts and let his crimper's hood drop. A crimper's hood, for those who've never had the occasion to be kidnapped and sold into slavery in one of the cities on the Iron Sea, looks a bit like a tent as it flutters quickly downward, borne by weights sewn into its bottom edges. Air pushes its flaps outward just before it drops down around its target's head and settles on his shoulders. Conte gave a startled jerk as Carlo yanked the black silk cord, instantly cinching the hood closed around his neck. Anyone with any real presence of mind could probably reach up and fumble such a hood loose in a matter of seconds, which is why the interior is inevitably painted with large amounts of some sweet-scented fuming narcotic purchased from a black apothecary. Knowing the nature of the man they were attempting to subdue, Locke and Carlo had spent nearly 30 crowns on the stuff Conte was breathing just now, and Locke fervently wished him much joy of it. One panic breath inside the airtight hood, that would be enough to drop any ordinary person in his or her tracks. But as Locke flew down the stairs to catch Conte's body, he saw that the man was still somehow upright, clawing at the hood, disoriented and weakened, most definitely, but still awake. A quick rap on the solar plexus, that would open his mouth and speed the drug on its way. Locke stepped in to deliver the blow, wrapping one hand around Conte's neck just beneath the crimper's hood. This nearly blew the entire game. Conte's arms flashed up and broke Locke's lackadaisical chokehold before it even began. The man's left arm snaked out to entangle Locke's right, and then Conte punched him. Once, twice, three times. Vicious jabs in his own stomach and solar plexus. With his guts an exploding constellation of pain, Locke sank down against his would-be victim, struggling for balance. Conte brought his right knee up in a blow that should have knocked Locke's teeth out of his ears at high speed, but the drug was finally, thankfully, smothering the old soldier's will to be ornery. The knee barely grazed Locke's chin. Instead, the booted foot attached to it caught him in the groin and knocked him backward. His head bounced against the hard marble of the stairs, somewhat cushioned by the cloth of his hood. Locke lay there, gasping for breath, still hanging awkwardly by one of the hooded man's arms. Carlo appeared at that instant, having dropped the line that cinched his crimper's hood and dashed down the stairs. He slipped one foot behind Conte's increasingly wobbly legs and pushed the man down the stairs, holding him by the front of his doublet to keep the fall relatively quiet. Once Conte was head down and prone, Carlo punched him rather mercilessly between the legs. Once, then again when the man's legs twitched feebly, and then again, which yielded no response. The hood had finally done its work. With Conte temporarily disposed of, Carlo turned to Locke and tried to help him to a sitting position, but Locke waved him off.
"What sort of state are you in?" Carlo whispered. "As though I'm with child and the little bastard is trying to cut his way out with an axe."
Chest heaving, Locke tore his black mask down off his face, lest he vomit inside it and create an unconcealable mess. While Locke gulped deep breaths and tried to control his shuddering, Carlo crouched back down beside Conte and tore the hood off, briskly waving away the sickly sweet aroma of the leather bag's contents. He carefully folded the hood up, slipped it into his cloak, and then dragged Conte up a few steps.
"Carlo!" Locke coughed. "My disguise! Damaged? Not that I can see. Looks like he didn't do anything that shows, provided you can walk without a slouch. Stay here a moment."
Carlo slipped down to the foot of the stairs and took a peek around the darkened solar. Soft city light fell through the barred windows, faintly illuminating a long table and a number of glass cases on the walls, holding plates and unidentifiable knick-knacks. Not another soul was in sight, and not a sound could be heard from below. When Carlo returned, Locke had pushed himself up on his knees and hands. Conte slumbered beside him with a look of comical bliss on his craggy face.
"Oh, he's not going to keep that expression when he wakes up."
Carlo waved a pair of thin, leather-padded brass knuckles at Locke, then made them vanish up his sleeves with a graceful flourish.
"I had my foot pads little friends on when I knocked him around that last time. Well, I for one have no expressions of sympathy to spare, since he kicked my balls hard enough to make them permanent residents of my lungs."
Locke tried to push himself up off his hands and failed. Carlo caught him under his right arm and eased him up until he was kneeling shakily on his knees alone.
"You've got your breath back at least. Can you actually walk?" "I can stumble, I think. I'll be hunched over for a while. Give me a few minutes, and I think I can pretend nothing's wrong, at least until we're out of here."
Carlo assisted Locke back up the stairs to the third floor. Leaving Locke there to keep watch, He then began to quietly, slowly drag Conte up the same way. The Don's man didn't actually weigh all that much. Embarrassed and eager to make himself useful again, Locke pulled two lengths of tough cord out of his own cloak and bound Conte's feet and hands with them. He folded a handkerchief three times and used it as a gag. Locke pulled Conte's knives out of their sheaths and passed them to Carlo, who stashed them within his cloak. The Don's study door still hung open, shedding warm light into the passage. The bedchamber doors remained locked tight.
"I pray you both may be gifted with a demand and an endurance well beyond your usual expectations, my lord and lady," whispered Carlo. "Your household thieves would appreciate a short break before continuing with their duties for the evening."
Carlo grasped Conte beneath his arms, and Locke, slouched in obvious pain, nonetheless grabbed the man's feet when Carlo began to drag him all by himself. With tedious stealth, they retraced their steps and deposited the unconscious bodyguard around the far bend in the corridor, just beside the stairs leading back up to the fourth-floor laboratories. The Don's study was a most welcome sight when they finally stole in a few minutes later. Locke settled into a deeply cushioned leather armchair on the left-hand wall, while Carlo took up a standing guard position. More laughter could be heard faintly from across the hall.
"We could be here quite a while," said Carlo.
"The gods are merciful." Locke stared at the Don's tall glass-fronted liquor cabinet, one even more impressive than the collection his pleasure barge carried.
"I'd pour us a draught or six, but I don't think it would be in character."
They waited 10 minutes. 15, 20. Locke breathed steadily and deeply, and concentrated on ignoring the throbbing ache that seemed to fill his guts from top to bottom. Yet when the two thieves heard the door across the hallway unbolting, Locke leapt to his feet, standing tall, pretending that his balls didn't feel like clay jugs dropped onto cobblestones from a great height. He cinched his black mask back on and willed a wave of perfect arrogance to claim him from the inside out. As Father Chains had once said, the best disguises were those that were poured out of the heart rather than painted on the face. Carlo kissed the back of his left hand through his own mask and winked. Don Lorenzo Salvara walked into his study whistling, lightly dressed and completely unarmed.
"Close the door,"
said Locke, and his voice was steady, rich with the absolute presumption of command.
"Have a seat, my lord, and don't bother calling for your man. He is indisposed."
7. An hour past midnight, two men left the Alcigrante district via the Eldrin Arch. They wore black cloaks and had black horses. One of them rode with a leisurely air, while the other led his horse on foot, walking in a curiously bow-legged fashion.
"Unfucking believable," said Carlo. "It really did work out just as you planned. It's a pity we can't brag about this to anyone. Our biggest score ever, and all we had to do was tell our mark exactly what we were doing to him."
"And get kicked around a bit," muttered Locke.
"Yeah, sorry about that. What a beast that man was, eh? Take comfort that he'll feel the same way when he opens his eyes again."
How very comforting. If reassurances could dull pain, nobody would ever go to the trouble of pressing grapes.
"By the crooked warden, I never heard such self-pity dripping from the mouth of a wealthy man. Cheer up! Richer and cleverer than everyone else, right?"
"Richer and cleverer and walking funny, yes." The pair of thieves made their way south through Two Silver Green, toward the first of the stops where they would gradually lose their horses and shed their black clothes, until they were finally heading back to the Temple District dressed as common labourers. They nodded companionably at patrols of yellow jackets, stomping about in the mist with lanterns swaying on pike poles to light their way. Not once were they given any reason to glance up. The fluttering shadow that trailed them on their way through the streets and alleys was quieter than a small child's breath. Swift and graceful, it swooped from rooftop to rooftop in their wake, following their actions with absolute single-mindedness. When they slipped back into the temple district, it beat its wings and rose into the darkness in a lazy, spiraling circle until it was up above the mists of Camor and lost against the grey haze of the low-hanging clouds. Interlude. The Last Mistake. 1. Locke's first experience with the mirror wine of Tal Verar had even more of an effect on the boy's malnourished body than Chains had expected. Locke spent most of the next day tossing and turning on his cot, his head pounding and his eyes unable to bear anything but the most gentle spark of light.
"It's a fever,"
Locke muttered into his sweat-soaked blanket.
"It's a hangover."
Chains ran a hand through the boy's hair and patted his back.
"My fault, really. The Sansa twins are natural liquor sponges. I shouldn't have let you live up to their standard on your first night with us. No work for you today."
"Liquor does this, even after you're sober?"
"A cruel joke, isn't it? The gods put a price tag on everything, it seems, unless you're drinking Osterschellen brandy."
"Offershallow?"
"Osterschellen. From Emberlane. Among its many other virtues, it doesn't cause a hangover. Some sort of alchemical component in the vineyard soil. Expensive stuff."
False light came after many hours of half-sleep, and Locke found himself able to walk once again, though the brain within his skull felt like it was attempting to dig a hole down through his neck and escape. Chains insisted that they would still be visiting Kappa Barsavi.
"The only people who break appointments with him are the ones that live in glass towers and have their pictures on coins, and even they think twice."
Though he consented to allow Locke a more comfortable means of transportation. It turned out that the House of Perelandro had a small stable tucked around the back, and in this smelly little stall there lived a gentled goat.
"He's got no name,"
Chains said, as he set Locke atop the creature's back.
"I just couldn't bring myself to give him one, since he wouldn't answer to it anyway."
Locke had never developed the instinctive revulsion most boys and girls felt for gentled animals. He'd already seen too much ugliness in his life to care about the occasional empty stare from a docile, milky-eyed creature. There is a substance called wraithstone, a chalky white material found in certain remote mountain caverns. The stuff doesn't occur naturally. It is found only in conjunction with glass-lined tunnels, presumably abandoned by the Eldrin, the same unsettling race that built Camor ages past. In its solid state, wraithstone is tasteless, nearly odorless, and inert. It must be burned to activate its unique properties. Physicists have begun to identify the various means and channels by which poisons attack the bodies of the living. This one stills the heart, while this one thins the blood, and still others damage the stomach or the intestines. Wraithstone smoke poisons nothing physical. What it does is burn out personality itself. Ambition, stubbornness, pluck, spirit, drive, all of these things fade with just a few breaths of the arcane haze. Accidental exposure to small amounts can leave a man listless for weeks. Anything more than that, and the effect will be permanent. Victims remain alive, but entirely unconcerned by anything. They don't respond to their names, or to their friends, or to mortal danger. They can be prodded into eating or excreting or carrying something, and little else. The pale white sheen that fills their eyes is an outward expression of the emptiness that takes hold in their hearts and minds. Once, in the time of the Therin throne, the process was used to punish criminals, but it has been centuries since any civilized Therin city-state allowed the use of wraithstone on men and women. A society that still hangs children for petty theft and feeds prisoners to sea creatures finds the results too disquieting to bear. Gentling, therefore, is reserved for animals, mostly beasts of burden intended for urban service. The cramped confines of a hazard-rich city like Camor are ideally suited to the process. Gentled ponies may be trusted never to throw the children of the wealthy. Gentled horses and mules may be trusted never to kick their handlers or dump expensive cargoes into a canal. A burlap sack with a bit of the white stone and a slow smouldering match is placed over an animal's muzzle, and the human handlers retreat to fresh air. A few minutes later, the creature's eyes are the color of new milk, and it will never do anything on its own initiative again. But Locke had a throbbing headache, and he was just getting used to the idea that he was a murderer and a resident of a private glass fairyland, and the eerily mechanical behavior of his goat didn't bother him at all. "This temple will be exactly where I left it when I return later this evening," said Father Chains as he finished dressing for his venture outside. The eyeless priest had vanished entirely, to be replaced by a hale man of middle years and moderate means. His beard and his hair had been touched up with some sort of brown dye. His vest and cheap cotton-lined half-cloak hung loosely over a cream-coloured shirt with no ties or cravats.
"Exactly where you left it," said one of the Sansas. "And not burned down or anything," said the other.
"If you boys can burn down stone and elderglass, the gods have higher aspirations for you than a place as my apprentices. Do behave. I'm taking Locke to get his,
Chains glanced sideways at the Lamora boy. He then mimed taking a drink and held his jaw afterward as though in pain.
"Oh,"
said Carlo and Galdo in pitch-perfect unison.
"Indeed."
Chains settled a little round leather cap on his head and took the reins of Locke's goat.
"Wait up for us. This should be interesting, to say the least."
2.
"This Kappa Barsavi,"
Locke said as Chains led the nameless goat across one of the narrow glass arches between the Fauna and Coin Kisser's Row.
"My old master told me about him, I think."
"You're quite right. That time you got the elderglass vine burned down, I believe."
"Ah, you know about that."
"Well, once your old master started telling me about you, he just sort of didn't shut up for several hours."
"If I'm your peasant, are you Barsavi's peasant?"
"That's a plain, neat description of our relationship, yes. All the right people are Barsavi's soldiers. His eyes, his ears, his agents, his subjects, his peasant. Barsavi is a particular sort of friend. I did some things for him back when he was coming to power. We rose together, you might say. I got special consideration, and he got the, entire city."
"Special consideration?"
It was as pleasant a night for a stroll as Camor ever produced during the summer. A hard rain had fallen not an hour before, and the fresh mist that spread its tendrils around buildings like the grasping hands of spectral giants was slightly cooler than usual, and its odor wasn't yet saturated with the redolence of silt and dead fish and human waste. Other people were few and far between on Coin Kisser's Row after false light, so Locke and Chains spoke fairly freely.
"I've got the distance, which means, well, there are 100 gangs in Camor, Locke. 100 and more. Certainly I can't remember them all. Some of them are too new or too unruly for Kappa Barsavi to trust them as well as he might. So he keeps a close eye on them, insists on frequent reports, plants men in them, reins their actions in tightly. Those of us that don't suffer such scrutiny," Chains pointed to himself, then to Locke, "are sort of presumed to be doing things honestly until proven otherwise. We follow his rules and pay him a cut of our take, and he thinks he can more or less trust us to get it right. No audits, no spies, no bullshit. The distance
It's a privilege worth paying for. Chain stuck a hand in one of his cloak pockets. There was the pleasing jingle of coins. I've got a little show of respect for him right here, in fact. 2/10 of this week's take from the charity kettle of Perelandro.
More than 100 gangs, you said?
This city has more gangs than it has foul odors, boy. Some of them are older than many families on the Alchigrante, and some of them have stricter rituals than some of the priestly orders. Hell, at one point there were nearly 30 coppers, and each one had 4 or 5 gangs under his thumb.
30 coppers? All like Coppa Barsavi?
Yes and no. Yes, that they ran gangs and gave orders and cut men open from cock to eyeballs when they got angry. No, that they were anything like Barsavi otherwise. 5 years ago, there were 30 bosses I talked about. 30 little kingdoms, all fighting and thieving and spilling each other's guts in the street. All at war with the Yellow Jackets, who used to kill 20 men a week in slow weeks. Then Coppa Barsavi walked in from Tal Varar. Used to be a scholar at the Therin Collegium, if you can believe it. Taught rhetoric. He got a few gangs under his thumb, and he started cutting. Not like a back-alley slasher, but more like a physica cutting out a canker. When Barsavi took out another Coppa, he took their gangs, too. But he didn't lean on them if he didn't have to. He gave them full territories and let them choose their own garistas, and he cut them in on his take. So, 5 years ago, there were 30. 4 years ago, there were 10. 3 years ago, there was 1. Coppa Barsavi and his 100 gangs. The whole city, all the right people, present company included, in his pocket. No more open war across the bloody canals. No more platoons of thieves getting strung up all at once at the Palace of Patience. Nowadays they have to do them 2 or 3 at a time.
Because of the secret peace, the one I broke?
The one you broke, yes. Good guess, presuming I'd know about that. Yes, my boy, it's the key to Barsavi's peculiar success. What it comes down to is, he has a standing agreement with the Duke, handled through one of the Duke's agents. The gangs of Camor don't touch the nobles. We don't lay a finger on ships or drays or crates that have a legitimate coat of arms on them. In exchange, Barsavi is the actual ruler of a few of the city's more charming points. Catchfire, the Narrows, the Dregs, the Wooden Waste, the Snare, and parts of the docks. Plus the city watch is much more relaxed than they ought to be.
So we can rob anyone who isn't a noble?
Or a yellow jacket, yes. We can have the merchants and the money changers and the incoming and the outgoing. There's more money passing through Camor than any other city on this coast, boy. Hundreds of ships a week, thousands of sailors and officers. We don't have any problem laying off the nobility.
Doesn't that make the merchants and the money changers and the other people angry?
It might if they knew about it. That's why there's that word secret in front of peace. And that's why Camor's such a lovely, fine, safe place to live. You really only need to worry about losing your money if you don't have much of it in the first place.
Oh, said Locke, fingering his little shark's tooth necklace. Okay. But now I wonder, you said my old master bought and paid for, killing me. Will you get in trouble with Barsavi for not killing me?
Chains laughed. Why would I be taking you to see him if that'd get me in trouble, boy? No, the death mark's mine to use or not, as I see fit. I bought it, don't you see? He doesn't care if we actually use him. Only that we acknowledge that the power of granting life or death is his. Sort of like a tax only he can collect. You see? Locke nodded, then allowed himself to be trundled along silently for a few minutes, absorbing all of this. His aching head made the scale of what was going on a bit difficult to grasp.
"Let me tell you a story," said Father Chains after a while. "A story that will let you know just what sort of man you're going to meet and swear fealty to this evening. Once upon a time, when Kappa Barsavi's hold on the city was very new and very delicate, it was an open secret that a pack of his garistas was plotting to get rid of him just as soon as the chance presented itself. And they were very alert for his countermoves, see? They'd helped him take over the city, and they knew how he worked. So they made sure he couldn't get all of them at once. If he tried to cut some throats, the gangs would scatter and warn each other, and it'd be a bloody mess, another long war. He made no open moves, and the rumors of their disloyalty got worse. Kappa Barsavi would receive visitors in his hall. It's still out there in the wooden waste. It used to be a big Ferrari hulk, one of those fat, wide galleons they used for hauling troops. It's just anchored there now, a sort of makeshift palace. He calls it the Floating Grave. Well, at the Floating Grave, he made a big show of putting down this one large carpet from Ashmere. A really lovely thing, the sort of cloth the Duke would hang on a wall for safekeeping. And he made sure that everyone around him knew how much he liked that carpet. It got so that his court could tell what he was going to do to a visitor by watching that carpet. If there was going to be blood, that carpet would be rolled up and packed away safe, without exception. Months went by. Carpet up, carpet down. Sometimes men who got called to see him would try to run the moment they saw bare floor beneath his feet, which of course was as good as admitting wrongdoing out loud. Anyhow, back to his problem garistas. Not one of them was stupid enough to enter the Floating Grave without a gang at their back, or to be caught alone with Barsavi. His rule was still too uncertain at this point for him to just throw a tantrum about it, so he waited. And then one night he invited 9 of his troublesome garistas to dinner. Not all the troublemakers, of course, but the cleverest and the toughest and the ones with the biggest gangs. And their spies brought back word that that lovely embroidered carpet, the Kappa's prized possession, was rolled out on the floor for everyone to see, with a banquet table on top of it and more food than the gods themselves had ever seen. So those stupid bastards, they figured Barsavi was serious, that he really wanted to talk. They thought he was scared, and they expected negotiations in good faith. So they didn't bring their gangs or make alternate plans. They thought they'd won. "You can imagine," said Chains, "just how surprised they were when they sat down at their chairs on that beautiful carpet, and 50 of Barsavi's men piled into the room with crossbows and shot those poor idiots so full of bolts that a porcupine in heat would have taken any one of them home and fucked him. If there was a drop of blood that wasn't on the carpet, it was on the ceiling. You get my meaning?"
"So the carpet was ruined?"
"And then some. Barsavi knew how to create expectations, Locke, and how to use those expectations to mislead those who would harm him. They figured his strange obsession was a guarantee of their lives. Turns out there are just some enemies numerous enough and powerful enough to be worth losing a damn carpet over." Chains pointed ahead of them and to the south. "That's the man waiting to talk to you about 1/2 mile that way. I would strongly recommend cultivating a civil tongue." 3. The last mistake was a place where the underworld of Camor bubbled to the surface, a flat-out crook's tavern where right people of every sort could drink and speak freely of their business, where respectable citizens stood out like serpents in a nursery and were quickly escorted out the door by mean-looking, thick-armed men with very small imaginations. Here entire gangs would come to drink and arrange jobs and just show themselves off. In their cups, men would argue loudly about the best way to strangle someone from behind and the best sorts of poisons to use in wine or food. They would openly proclaim the folly of the Duke's court, or his taxation schemes, or his diplomatic arrangements with the other cities of the Iron Sea. They would refight entire battles with dice and fragments of chicken bones as their armies, loudly announcing how they would have turned left when Duke Nicovante had gone right, how they would have stood fast when the 5,000 blackened iron spears of the Mad Count's rebellion had come surging down Godsgate Hill toward them. But not one of them, no matter how far doused in liquor or gaze or the strange narcotic powders of Jerem, no matter what feats of generalship or statecraft he credited himself with the foresight to bring off, would dare suggest to Capa Vencarlo Barsavi that he should ever change so much as a single button on his waistcoat. 4. The Broken Tower is a landmark of Camor, jutting 90 feet skyward at the very northern tip of the Snare, that low and crowded district where sailors from 100 ports of call are passed from bar to alehouse to gaming den and back again on a nightly basis. They are shaken through a sieve of tavern keepers, whores, muggers, dicers, cobblecogs, and other low tricksters until their pockets are as empty as their heads are heavy, and they can be dumped on ship to nurse their new hangovers and diseases. They come in like the tide and go out like the tide, leaving nothing but a residue of copper and silver, and occasionally blood, to mark their passing. Although human arts are inadequate to the task of cracking elder glass, the Broken Tower was found in its current state when humans first settled Camor, stealing in among the ruins of an older civilization. Great gashes mar the alien glass and stone of the tower's upper stories. These discontinuities have been somewhat covered over with wood and paint and other human materials. The sturdiness of the whole affair is hardly in question, but the repairs are not beautiful, and the rooms for let on the upper 6 floors are some of the least desirable in the city, as they are accessible only by rank upon rank of narrow, twisting exterior stairs, a spindly wooden frame that sways nauseatingly in high winds. Most of the residents are young bravos from various gangs, to whom the insane accommodations are a strange badge of honour. The last mistake fills the first floor at the wide base of the Broken Tower, and after the fall of false light, it rarely has less than 100 patrons in it at any given time. Locke clung tightly to the back of Father Chain's half-cloak as the older man elbowed his way past the crowd at the door. The outward exhalation of the bar's air was full of smells Locke knew quite well. 100 kinds of liquors and the breath of the men and women drinking them, sweat both stale and fresh, piss and vomit, spiced pomanders and wet wool, the sharp bite of ginger and the acrid fog of tobacco.
"Can we trust that boy to watch our goat?"
Locke cried above the din.
"Of course, of course."
Chains made some elaborate hand sign in greeting to a group of men arm-wrestling just inside the bar's main room. Those not locked in bitter struggles grinned and waved back.
"First, it's his job. Second, I paid well. Third, only a crazy person would want to steal a gentled goat."
The last mistake was a sort of monument to the failure of human artifice at critical moments. Its walls were covered in a bewildering variety of souvenirs, each one telling a visual tale that ended with the phrase, "not quite good enough." Above the bar was a full suit of armour, a square hole punched through at the left breast by a crossbow quarrel. Broken swords and split helmets covered the walls, along with fragments of oars, masts, spars, and tatters of sails. One of the bar's proudest claims was that it had secured a memento of every ship that had foundered within sight of Camor in the past 70 years. Into this mess Father Chains dragged Locke Lamora, like a launch being towed at the stern of a huge galleon. On the south wall of the bar was an elevated alcove, given privacy by rows of partially drawn curtains. Men and women stood at attention here, their hard eyes constantly sweeping across the crowd, their hands never far from the weapons they carried openly and ostentatiously. Daggers, darts, brass and wooden clubs, short swords, hatchets, and even crossbows, ranging from slender alley pieces to big horse murderers that looked, to Locke's wide eyes, as though they could knock holes in stone. One of these guards stopped Father Chains, and the two exchanged a few whispered words. Another guard was dispatched into the curtained alcove, while the first eyed Chains warily. A few moments later, the second guard reappeared and beckoned. Thus it was that Locke was led for the first time into the presence of Vencarlo Barsavi, Kappa of Camor, who sat in a plain chair beside a plain table. Several minions stood against the wall behind him, close enough to respond to a summons, but far enough to be out of earshot for quiet conversation. Barsavi was a big man, as wide as Chains, but obviously a bit younger. His oiled black hair was pulled tight behind his neck, and his beards curved off his chin like three braided whipcords of hair, one atop the other, neatly layered. These beards flew about when Barsavi turned his round head, and they looked quite thick enough to sting if they struck bare skin. Barsavi was dressed in a coat, vest, breeches, and boots of some odd dark leather that seemed unusually thick and stiff even to Locke's untrained eyes. After a moment, the boy realized it must be shark hide. The strangely uneven white buttons that dotted his vest and his cuffs and held his layered red silk cravats in place, they were human teeth. Sitting on Barsavi's lap, staring intently at Locke, was a girl about his own age, with short, tangled, dark hair and a heart-shaped face. She, too, wore a curious outfit. Her dress was white-embroidered silk, fit for any noble's daughter, while the little boots that dangled beneath her hem were black leather, shod with iron, bearing sharpened steel kicking spikes at the heels and the toes. "So this is the boy," said Barsavi, in a deep, slightly nasal voice with the pleasant hint of a Ferrari accent. "The industrious little boy who so confounded our dear thief-maker."
"The very one, Your Honour, now happily confounding myself and my other wards."
Chains reached behind himself and pushed Locke out from behind his legs.
"May I present Locke Lamora, late of Shades Hill, now an initiate of Perelandro?"
"Or some god, anyway, eh?"
Barsavi chuckled and held out a small wooden box that had been resting on the table near his arm.
"It's always nice to see you when your sight miraculously returns, Chains. Have a smoke. Their Jeremite Blackroot, extra fine, just rolled this week."
"I can't say no to that, Ven."
Chains accepted a tightly rolled sheaf of tobacco in red paper. While the two men bent over a flickering taper to light up, Chains dropped his little bag of coins on the table at the same time, the girl seemed to come to some sort of decision about Locke.
"He's a very ugly little boy, Father. He looks like a skeleton."
Kappa Barsavi coughed out his first few puffs of smoke, the corners of his mouth crinkling upward.
"And you're a very inconsiderate little girl, my dear."
The Kappa drew on his sheaf once more and exhaled a straight stream of translucent smoke. The stuff was pleasantly mellow and carried the slightest hint of burnt vanilla.
"You must forgive my daughter Nazca. I am helpless to deny her indulgences, and she has acquired the manners of a pirate princess, particularly now that we are all afraid to come near her deadly new boots."
"I am never unarmed," said the little girl,
kicking up her heels a few times to emphasize the point.
"And poor Locke most certainly is not ugly, my darling. What he bears is clearly the mark of Shades Hill. A month in Chains' keeping, and he'll be as round and fit as a catapult stone."
"Hmm.
The girl continued to stare down at him for a few seconds, then suddenly looked up at her father, absently toying with one of his braided beards while she did so.
"Are you making him a peasant, father?"
"Chains and I did have that in mind, sweetling, yes."
"Hmm. Then I want another brandy while you're doing the ceremony."
Kappa Barsavi's eyes narrowed. Seams deepened by habitual suspicion drew in around his flinty grey stare.
"You've already had your two brandies for the night, darling. Your mother will murder me if I let you have another. Ask one of the men to get you a beer."
"But I prefer..."
"What you prefer, little tyrant, has nothing to do with what I am telling you. For the rest of the night, you can drink beer or air. The choice is entirely yours."
"I'll have beer, then."
Barsavi reached out to lift her down, but she hopped off his lap just ahead of his thick-fingered, heavily calloused hands. Her heels went clack, clack, clack on the hardwood floor of the alcove as she ran to some minion to give her order.
"And if just one more of my men gets kicked in the shin, darling, you're going to wear reed sandals for a month, I promise."
Barsavi shouted after her, then took another drag of tobacco and turned back to Locke and Chains.
"She's a keg of fire oil, that one. Last week she refused to sleep at all unless we let her keep a little garrote under her pillows.
Just like Daddy's bodyguards," she said.
"I don't think her brothers yet realize that the next Kappa Barsavi might wear summer dresses and bonnets."
"I can see why you might have been amused by the thief-maker's stories about our boy here,"
Chains said, clasping both of Locke's shoulders as he spoke.
"Of course, I have become very hard to shock since my children grew above the tops of my knees. But you're not here to discuss them. You've brought me this little man so he can take his first and last oath as a peasant. A few years early, it seems. Come here, Locke."
Kappa Barsavi reached out with his right hand and turned Locke's head slightly upward by the chin, staring down into Locke's eyes as he spoke.
"How old are you, Locke Lamora? 6, 7? Already responsible for a breach of the peace, a burnt-down tavern, and 6 or 7 deaths?"
The Kappa smirked.
"I have assassins 5 times your age. Who should be so bold? Has Chains told you the way it is with my city and my laws?"
Locke nodded.
"You know that once you take this oath, I can't go easy on you ever again. You've had your time to be reckless. If Chains needs to put you down, he will. If I tell him to put you down, he will."
Again, Locke nodded. Nazca returned to her father's side, sipping from a tarred leather alejack. She stared at Locke over the rim of this drinking vessel, which she had to clutch in both hands. Kappa Barsavi snapped his fingers. One of the toadies in the background vanished through a curtain.
"Then I'm not going to bore you with any more threats, Locke. This night, you're a man. You will do a man's work and suffer a man's fate if you cross your brothers and sisters. You will be one of us, one of the right people. You'll receive the words and the signs, and you'll use them discreetly. As Chains, Yogarista is sworn to me, so you are sworn to me through him. I am Yogarista above all Garistas. I am the only Duke of Camor you will ever acknowledge. Bend your knee."
Locke knelt before Barsavi. The Kappa held out his left hand, palm down. He wore an ornate ring of black pearl in a white iron setting. Nestled inside the pearl by some arcane process was a speck of red that had to be blood.
"Kiss the ring of the Kappa of Camor."
Locke did so. The pearl was cool beneath his dry lips.
"Speak the name of the man to whom you have sworn your oath."
"Kappa Barsavi,"
Locke whispered. At that moment, the Kappa's underling returned to the alcove and handed his master a small crystal tumbler filled with dull brown liquid. "Now," said Barsavi, "as has every one of my Pezan, you will drink my toast." From one of the pockets of his waistcoat, the Kappa drew a shark's tooth, one slightly larger than the death mark Locke wore around his neck. Barsavi dropped the tooth into the tumbler and swirled it around a few times. He then handed the tumbler to Locke. "It's dark sugar rum from the Sea of Brass. Drink the entire thing, including the tooth. But don't swallow the tooth, whatever you do. Keep it in your mouth. Draw it out after all the liquor is gone. And try not to cut yourself." Locke's nose smarted from the stinging aroma of hard liquor that wafted from the tumbler, and his stomach lurched, but he ground his jaws together and stared down at the slightly distorted shape of the tooth within the rum. Silently praying to his new benefactor to save him from embarrassment, he dashed the contents of the glass into his mouth, tooth and all. Swallowing was not as easy as he'd hoped. He held the tooth against the roof of his mouth with his tongue, gingerly, feeling its sharp points scrape against the back of his upper front teeth. The liquor burned. He began to swallow in small gulps that soon turned into wheezing coughs. After a few interminable seconds, he shuddered and sucked down the last of the rum, relieved that he had held the tooth carefully in place. It twisted in his mouth. Twisted physically, as though wrenched by an unseen hand, and scored a burning slash across the inside of his left cheek. Locke cried out, coughed, and spat up the tooth. It lay there in his open palm, flecked with spit and blood. "Ah," said Kappa Barsavi, as he plucked the tooth up and slipped it back into his waistcoat, blood and all. "So you see, you are bound by an oath of blood to my service. My tooth has tasted of your life, and your life is mine. So let us not be strangers, Locke Lamora. Let us be Kappa and Pezan, as the crooked warden intended." At a gesture from Barsavi, Locke stumbled to his feet, already inwardly cursing the now familiar sensation of liquor rapidly going to his head. His stomach was empty from the day's hangover. The room was already swaying a bit around him. When he set eyes on Nazca once again, he saw that she was smiling at him above her ale-jack, with the air of smarmy tolerance the older children in Shades Hill had once shown to him and his compatriots in streets. Before he knew what he was doing, Locke bent his knee to her as well.
"If you're the next Kappa Barsavi," he said rapidly, "I should swear to serve you too. I do, Madam, Madam Nazca. I mean, Madame Barsavi."
The girl took a step back.
"I already have servants, boy. I have assassins. My father has 100 gangs and 2,000 knives."
"Nazca Bellona Genovese Angelise de Barsavi," her father thundered. "Now it seems you only grasp the value of strong men as servants. In time you will come to see the value of gracious ones as well. You shame me!"
Nonplussed, the girl glanced back and forth between Locke and her father several times. Her cheeks slowly turned red. After a few more moments of pouting consideration, she stiffly held out her ale-jack to Locke.
"You may have some of my beer."
Locke responded as though this were the deepest honour ever conferred upon him, realizing, though hardly in so many words, all the while that the liquor was somehow running a sort of rump parliament in his brain that had overruled his usual cautious social interactions, especially with girls. Her beer was bitter, dark stuff, slightly salted. She drank like a Ferrari. Locke took two sips to be polite, then handed it back to her, bowing in a rather noodle-necked fashion as he did so. She was too flustered to say anything in return, so she merely nodded.
"Ha! Excellent!"
Kappa Barsavi chomped on his slender cigar in mirth.
"Your first Pezan!" Of course, both of your brothers are going to want some just as soon as they hear about this.
5. The trip home was a muggy, misty blur to Locke. He'd clung to the neck of his gentled goat while Chains led them back north toward the temple district, frequently cackling to himself.
"Oh, my boy," he muttered, "my dear, dear, charming sot of a boy. It was all bullshit, you realize."
"What?"
"The shark's tooth. Kappa Barsavi had a bondsmage enchant that thing for him in Carthane years ago. Nobody can swallow it without cutting themselves. He's been carrying it around ever since. All those years he spent studying Throne Therin Theatre have given him a substantial fetish for the dramatic."
"So it wasn't, like, fate or the gods or anything like that?"
"It was just a shark's tooth with a tiny bit of sorcery. A good trick, I have to admit."
Chains rubbed his own cheek in sympathy and remembrance. "No, Locke, you don't belong to Barsavi. He's good enough for what he is, a powerful ally to have on your side, and a man that you must appear to obey at all times. But he certainly doesn't own you. In the end, neither do I."
"So I don't have to..."
"Obey the secret peace, be a good little pezon. Only for pretend, Locke. Only to keep the wolves from the door. Unless your eyes and ears have been stitched shut with rawhide these past 2 days, by now you must have realized that I intend you and Carlo and Galdo and Sabatha to be nothing less," Chains confided through a feral grin, "than a fucking ballista bolt right through the heart of Ven Carlo's precious secret peace."